Here we go. This is Ed Gray and Susan Gibney, and we have been partners in ministry since the days of Sunny Hills and David Skates and John Free. And you know, when Susan contacted me a few years ago, and we've stayed in touch through the years, hey, Ed, let's do some stuff together. It's kind of like having your superhero ask you to come play on their team. Because when my wife, Rhonda, and I were young pups of a couple, she and her husband, Terry, like Terry Gibney, they were role models for us. And so we're delighted to be here. Susan, take it away.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ed. What are you going to say? You're going to be tired of being welcomed, I know, all week. Now, you'll notice that I have a paper in front of me, and he looks at the screen. So this is a generational thing, okay, just so you know. But anyway, but we want to welcome, because we feel like this topic is so vital, and you must be, because you're here, because we're talking about seniors. In a minute, we'll maybe try to figure out what a senior is. In fact, I worship at a college university. They always say we're going to have a senior dinner for something. I'm thinking, oh, but they mean senior in college, not me. But so we'll define a senior. But we want to learn to respect them and understand them and learn to serve them and mobilize them. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing here, lots of things that we're going to be doing. But we really, for me, it's kind of like I really want us to understand what it is to be a senior and the value of those later years. I love seeing all ages here. It's so important. And I think we need to honor that. We need to honor the whole lifespan. And that's what we're about. You probably have seen the commercial that says we're not growing older, we're living longer. and it's true. You know, we are living longer. And what are the implications of living longer? And what does that mean, not just to us personally, but what does it mean to our families? What does it mean to our churches in that? And I think also we want to think, you know, how old is a senior citizen? I mean, what's a senior citizen? How old do you think you have to be a senior citizen?
Art says 55.
55, and that seems so young to me. But yeah.
10 years older than I am.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. And you know, I remember the first time my husband and I went to a theater somewhere, and I think maybe we were at 55, or I was, or he was, maybe. And they asked if we wanted to. I thought, senior discount? I'm not that old. But you know, what does it mean? Sometimes it's 50, 55, 60, 65, whatever. So I think I'm going to let you define that when we think about what is a senior citizen. But very briefly, Ed and I are just going to tell you who we are, simply because I know sometimes for me, if someone has a topic they're talking about, I'm like, so who are they and why do they talk about that? You know, why is this a passion for them? For me, I'm what's called a certified family life educator, and my graduate work was in human development, family studies. I love it. It's just what I love. And I've taught it for years, taught other things, but that's what I really like. And for me, remember, human development is not just learning about children. It's learning the whole lifespan development. And I'm getting at the end of that lifespan, so I know long lifespan. And so that's what I want us to think about and respect. So I'm a retired professor from here at Pepperdine University. I worked in the education department. I'm a widow of many more years than I want. Hi, I'm glad you're here, Chi. Anyway, this is fun. I keep looking up and seeing friends. And so I became a widow early in my life. At least I thought it was early. You know, sometimes you think widows need to be elderly. Of course, I don't even think I am yet, but I am, I guess. I'm a cancer survivor, so I have that whole part of my life and understanding, shall we say, aging issues at that time. So I've been a caregiver for a premature son, for my parents, for a disabled sister that I cared for many years, and, of course, my husband dying of cancer. So I know that part of life, too, with caregiving. I'm the mother of three, an in-law of three, a grandmother of 10, so that's, you know, the best part. In these senior years, I'm active at church and missions and college student house group. I teach in a women's prison. I teach women inmates, premarital couples, conferences.
I'm on four different boards, writer of various periodicals, certified in what they call spiritual gerontology, all of that. So what I'm saying is, I qualify. I'm your visual aid today. Okay, that's what I am. And so I work with and for seniors. Love that. Retirement is not a four-letter word. Okay, some people think, oh, that's the end of life, and I'll talk more about that. But it's not. To me, I just love what I do. I don't get paid for it anymore. As we look at that. So sometimes in the course of today, I'll say them or we or me because it's a little identity crisis here when I talk about seniors. I am one. So if I use all of those pronouns, just understand it's still me. Okay, Ed, who are you?
All right. Well, Ed and Rhonda is how I love to introduce my wife and I. We lived in Southern California for 13 years, enjoyed some great years at Sunny Hills, and some other work in private practice and an agency here in Southern California. And then for 22 years, I've been back in Memphis, Tennessee at the Harding School of Theology. Counseling professor, I direct our master's in counseling program. You'll notice some shameless promotion in your flyer there. You know anybody that wants to study with us and get licensed to be a licensed professional counselor, marriage and family therapist? That's what I do. And then my passion is Rod and I go and we speak on ministry topics, marriage mentoring, marriage enrichment, weekends with churches. We always love coming back to California and connecting with friends. So if we can do anything for you, we'd love to do that. We have three adult sons grown out of the house. We have a pay raise with our kids grown and doing well on their own. So we're happy about that and love them dearly. Love working together. Susan and I have done several things through the years, and so it's great to be here with you today. I am a licensed counselor. I do about 10 to 12 hours a week of private practice still, along with my Harding School of Theology work. So that's kind of what I do. So I do a little more on the academic side and then the practical counseling side of folks. So that's what we bring today.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you are the Harding School of Theology, which means we need psychology work in our churches?
I think that's a great blend.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Dr. Free and I would be glad to have a discussion with you at break time.
No, I agree, we do.
All right.
All aspects of who we are. And I've already been able to meet most of you. We're not going to go around the room. It would take too long. But just as a group generally, we have people from all over. I know California can raise several from California. Yeah. But we have some from out of state, I know, and are some from out of the country. Where are you from? You want to tell them?
From Nigeria.
Nigeria. Isn't that wonderful? And she's lovely. Anybody else from out of the country? Yes, sir. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Canada.
Okay, my father was Canadian.
How about Texas?
Yeah.
All right.
Excellent. We always have some of those. How many of you are maybe in a church that, I guess you'd say small for us? I mean, remember, I'm from California, so numbers are a little different than if you're from Texas. But if you're in a church, let's say, of 200 or less, a smaller church, okay, good, because I really believe in good things.
We're going to have, even for small churches, sometimes you think, what can we do? There's going to be a lot that you're going to take away from here today.
Yeah, we're going to make you full, get your pockets full of stuff. How many, like a mid-sized church, let's say up to, I don't even know what number for that.
How about 200 to 500?
Yeah. How many from that? Okay.
200 to 500.
Okay. Okay. How about a mega church, more than that?
500.
I just came from a luncheon where, what is it, 2,300 church? I mean, that's to me a mega church.
Just 600.
Just
over your.
Okay, that's good. That's good. And the reason I ask that is what we'll do today applies to all of you, but the way you employ it might be a little different in how you're actually using it, I think, in your church. How many of you have worked directly with like a formal, let's say, seniors ministry? Some of you have. Okay, not too many, which is not surprising. And that, how many of you wish that your church or your community understood and maybe had more for seniors in your church now. So more of us kind of want a little bit of that. So anyway, today what you can look forward to at the end of the class, if you want it, we have some certificates for you. Some of you, maybe when you go back to your churches or some certification needs you have, that will be available to you.
How many of you signed up and web registered? Okay, you'll have yours already pre-printed. For those of you who are so welcome, we've got some blank ones, and you can fill your own name in on that.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah, that's right. The other thing is, you know, you all got a folder, I hope. And in that folder, and we will refer to them, we will put several handouts there for you. We also have just blank paper. There's pens back there, too, if you don't have anything to write with. Because we really want you to make this your class. Apply to your church, apply to your world, apply to the people you know, okay? So as we go through the class, think about, oh, yeah, I know so-and-so, or yeah, I should. So make a note of that, okay? That's important to us to do that. So these handouts are, the other thing is probably after the break, we have three booklets that Ed and I have written together that we will kind of show you how to use them and how to have small groups or large groups, whatever, in the certain topics that we'll be sharing with you at that time. We have snacks for the break. Up here we got lots of water, lots of all kinds of granola bars to stuff your pockets with those, whatever
you
want.
Susan's a little sensitive. It's not the presentation she would like out of the box, but at least you know what you're getting.
That's right. We need to let them know what kind they're getting. So, anyway, and that's kind of a, where did the little goodie thing go?
I got it.
Oh, okay.
In fact, you're ready.
Okay, I am. Okay. We wanted to talk to you briefly about, can you hear me, by the way?
Yes.
It's really hard. I mean, there's a microphone, but just to stand there all the time, I have to move a little bit. So if you can hear me, usually my voice projects okay. I've been teaching long enough to where usually I can get that across. So
if you have any difficulty, we read body language well, so if you do this, we'll know to take it up a notch.
Yeah.
All right?
Especially in the back, because it's very frustrating if you can't hear.
I resemble that comment.
But, you know, just let us know. We want you to be comfortable. We want you to know you'll be here for a while, Lord willing, and to know what to expect. As far as the vision for the workshop, Mike Cope, a couple of years ago we were talking, and the need to have what we call extended workshops like this. So 45 minutes is really hard to get a lot done in any depth at all. And so we have the privilege of having you here longer than that so that we can give you a little depth, breadth and depth, in what we want to do. I think also for this, not all of us, and I'm thrilled to see people who aren't seniors here because that's what's going to help our senior ministry. I think for us, many times, we are okay in a group like this with someone talking and you're listening and the PowerPoint, I mean, that's kind of... You're okay. You don't need a lot of technology sometimes to be attentive to. In fact, sometimes that's disturbing to you. So maybe that'll help you as we address what we're going to do. As it says here, we're the first half of life culture. I mean, that's really when you think about our culture in America and other countries maybe too, all the emphasis seems to be on what we call the first half of life culture. And there's little consideration sometimes given for the second half. I was at a conference recently, and they stated that we're overly prepared for the first half of life and underprepared for the second half of life. Does that make sense to you? I'll show you something in a minute. But, you know, think about what are we prepared for? And that's what we find, especially in the churches. We just say, oh, they're, you know, kids are out of the house. They know everything now. They don't need anything. So we tend to be over-prepared for that first half and not for the second half. And I think for the church and church leaders, there's a lot of implications here that I think would be helpful to listen to. With all the reading and studying I've done, I realize that there's much evidence for the need of using seniors and finding out who we are. Now, we have a resource list in your packet there, and there's so you don't have to look it up. But this is one book where it's called Grain of the Flock, you know, and that's kind of what we are, the grain of the flock, and that's in your resource. But that's what he mentions here in this book. So I pray that most of you will get your needs met as a senior, will be able to serve as a senior, will be able to work with and for seniors and what we do. Now, of course, there's. I want you to understand, you don't have to have a formal ministry, you know. I mean, you have, it's just being aware, I think, sometimes, and then it creates a ministry in what you do. But the awareness is what we want you to start with today as you work with seniors. There's a lot of humor and stereotypes but not statistics yet. But there is humor, and that's okay. We got to laugh at ourselves, I think, a little bit. Just recently, I saw a sign that said, "No senior citizen discounts. You've had twice as long to get the money." Oh, okay. Or it said, this study said, it wasn't really a study, but it said, the brains of older people are slow because they have so much inside. You know, they've just stored so much in there. That's a good one. And you probably seen the TV show, The Waltons. And I heard Grandma Walton on that say once, she said, "There are no wrinkles on my mind or my spirit, just my face." I kind of like that. Or the one that says, "If it doesn't hurt, it's not working." Or the little girl that said, "My teacher says, little girls can grow up to be anything they choose. Why did you choose to be an old lady?" So sometimes we act accordingly to what we believe about our stage in life or someone else's stage in life with this. It's good to laugh. But remember, old age is not a disease. We may have diseases, but it's not. And sometimes I think we treat it that way. So little statistics that we're going to... There we go. Okay, just to highlight, again, on the white page in your handout on one side or the other, some of them are there so you don't have to worry about taking too many notes if you're interested in it. It should say there. The psalmist said, "Teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom." The numbering of our days means more than counting them, I think. It might mean using our days purposefully to gain wisdom and live purposely well into our old age. And that's what I want, and I'm sure you want. An aging church is not a crisis. Remember, we have aging churches. It's not. But it is a spiritual opportunity. And I'm seeing that more and more as I get in that. So just briefly in our statistics here, with the boomers, I think, yeah, the boomers, that's... somewhere around 1946 to 64 when they're born. They're about maybe 15, 65 years old. They're considered young seniors or middle adulthood. This particular group sees themselves as middle-aged and is the most difficult to interest in a ministry like this. They're the wealthiest, most active, most physically fit of the generation. They tend to be independent and open-minded about social values. 60% list they have a value in investing for the future. 42% delay retirement, and 25% claim they don't ever want to retire.
They may be the most recent resistors to senior ministry.
That's right.
And so you may have to start calling it older adults ministry.
Yeah.
If you want to engage your boomers,
yeah.
They don't want to be seniors.
They don't. Yeah, and there's a lot of identity there, words we use, how we want to use it. Although, you know, the over-the-hill stuff and all that, I don't know. You know, but you can come up with something maybe more creative than that. But he's right, because, and this is Ed's generation, you know, that's. But we have to understand those generations and those ages, because whether we're older than them or younger than them, we still have to get into the culture of how they see it. Now, the builders, some call it that, born anywhere from maybe 1925 to 1945, usually are ages about 66 to 82. They're considered, in this study, older adults. They are children of the Great Depression, with the impact that goes with that, such as saving a lot, not wasting. They're financially conservative, and generally the most generous givers at church. They tend to be more of the traditionalists, and this is me. This is my generation.
We have them to thank for a lot of our church buildings.
Yes.
Think about it. Mm-hmm. They put the money into it. That was a value to them, and it does provide stability for a fellowship.
Mm-hmm. And I think even because of what, I'm on college campus, and of course, I say the students are always 18 to 22. They are always the same age. I'm not. I keep changing. it's good for them, but you know, for them to realize, guess where their scholarships are coming from? Yeah. Not their peers. They're coming from my generation. Yeah. That's where the money's coming from. And they need to respect that, and I think leaders in our church need to respect that probably the most generous givers are not the younger ones. And so not that money is all about it, but I think you need to understand that that's part of it. Then the elders, that's what they call, they're born prior to 1925, maybe over the age of 82. They're considered, in this study, which I know, old. But this is the greatest generation. Tom Brokaw named, and they've certainly caught on. They're the most loyal, patriotic, and they love tradition. Now let me show you something. There should be the pie. Yeah, it's a little bit, not quite a pie, but that's okay. An oval here. This is kind of an old one, but it's from a study from Evelyn DeVal, and she was looking at lifespan development. And what was interesting to me, and you can hit the other good things there. Okay, if you see the numbers here, that means what age group or what season of life it is. For instance, we have married, no children, childbearing, preschooler, school age, teenagers, launching. That's all about here, about the number of years.
So from 12 o'clock on the clock to 6, you have that first half, if you will.
And that's where our whole society and our world prepares you for that. You know, and parenting, marriage, launching our kids, the career. But guess what? What's on the other half? What's me? No, the emptiness, retirement. So the point is, if you look at this, this is not the end of life. There's ever so much more, Lord willing, that you will have there, and the people in the church have, the people in the world have. So when you think about that, you need to think about, the second half of life. How do we prepare for that? And there, it doesn't mean we can take a class, but it means our kind of our life and what it's like. And as we look and as we respect that in our senior ministry and realize there's a lot left. You know, when I reached this stage and that, I thought that's not the end. Although when your children leave home, you do feel that. But now I thought, you know, I've got a lot of good left in me. You know, there's more to go. So think about that when we're talking about the importance of these years, this other half of the pie, shall we say. We, by the way, eat your AWP pie.
And cookies.
Yeah, right. So, okay. So then, more statistics here. In 1900, the life expectancy was 47. Imagine, it's grown to 78.8 now, and I know this varies, but generally, that was in 2012, this particular study. However, suicides have increased in the elderly. That's a little scary to think about. So something's happening in that age group that we're ignoring, that we're not paying attention to, because they, and we'll talk more, but they're getting lonely, despondent. A lot of ways the churches can reach out to them and help them. The number of people age 65 and older is expected to double in the next 25 years. Right now, it's about 1 in 5 that are aged. So, in other words, we're not going away. Okay. Americans are more likely to reach the age of 90 now in that culture. The divorce rate, though, has doubled for those over 50. So who says you don't need Ed or John or others as far as senior marriage groups? It's not just because they got married, that's not the end of. I do premarital counseling. Although I've had older couples in those classes, and they're great fun to have. But to remember, we still need to work in their marriages, and they do too, in all these senior years, because we're seeing these statistics coming out there.
A lot of what's going on there is because couples are not taking care of their marriage. When they start launching the kids and the empty nest has finally occurred, they kind of look at each other and say, I don't know you. I don't like you. I don't want to be with you anymore. So the kids are out of the home. They divorce. And it's really sad. And it's not that we need to start all of a sudden an emphasis on marriage. We need to be doing an emphasis on healthy marriage in their mid-30s, in their mid-40s. So when they hit age 50 and beyond, they've got a vibrancy in their marriage that still keeps them ticking.
I know when our children left, and I loved being a mom, and I loved having them home, and I had a bit of an identity crisis. You know, I'm not my mom anymore, but I survived that time. And my husband was still alive then, and we had some wonderful years. I wish we'd have still had them. But we do find that there is a crisis point when that pie chart gets there. And crisis means improve or not. It doesn't mean the end. We talk about crisis. So what we want to do is see that's a very vulnerable time in their lives and to work in their marriages as well as other things, not just their financial retirement plan and all of that. Those are good, but we need to think about relationships. So the divorce rate has doubled for those over 50. Population demographic shifts in the next 50 years in the United States show from birth to 14, that age group, an increase of 36%, while at the same time, the senior adult population will increase 127%. Ages 14 to 44, only 24.2%. Are you hearing something as we're getting to this point? Are you hearing the reason that we felt like this was an important topic? Our nation has more senior citizens than adolescents, but more youth ministers than senior ministers. So let's think of some implications here. 1 in 4 senior adult females, live alone compared to 1 in 20 males. Men have a greater chance of remarrying because of the ratio of senior men to women is 7 to 10, and they tend to remarry younger women. Women outlive men by about 7 years. So to a large extent, the future of the church is senior adults, and maybe widows, if that be.
I think we have something in the book of Acts about ministry to widows and the waiting of tables.
Yeah. And I'll talk about widows a little more. I'm going to talk a lot about it because I am one. And young one, I see that world. I've had the good married world, but I see a different world for them. So think about this during the class. What I want you to do is certainly take all the notes you want to. But what I like to do when I in something like this, I also like to write down names of people. I don't need to know those names. But maybe we're talking about and you want to say, you know, Jane, I need to kind of reach out to Jane. I never thought about this. Or I need to go next door to my... But if there's something like that that the Lord has put in your heart, write that down in a column or something. That's what I do. And when you get home, look at it and remind yourself that the Lord put that person or that idea or on your heart in the course of the class. So I want to encourage you to do that if you want to. Because with the later years rapidly shaping up to be the longest period of your life, greater than your childhood, your adolescence, early adulthood, or middle age, a true, what we call developmental psychology, is emerging for this age group. Most retirees do not, they don't want to be idle. You know, they don't want to feel like they're at the pasture. Now, some maybe want to go from one cruise to another, and that may be fine. I like them, but I'd be bored. I have to feel more productive. I guess in that is my nature and that. But if you don't reach out to them, that may not happen. Most of them do. A book I read recently, she said here in the book, to insist on living until we die may be one of life's greatest virtues. Just insist on living until we die. My husband, some of you knew him, and he was interesting and funny sometimes. Sometimes I wondered if it was appropriate, but we did know he was dying, and we sadly have many months of that process. And so, of course, he was weakening, but still getting around, and people would tell him to stop doing that and stop doing that. But he said, you know, don't bury me till I'm dead. And it's funny and it's sad all together. But when you said that, I was like, Terry, I can't believe you said that. But he was right. He didn't want to say, let me be what I am. Let me live my life. Let me live it to the fullest. Let me contribute what I can now. And he did as long as he could, and his body allowed him to do that. But we seniors also need to be reminded to be approachable. In other words, we need to be that way. I think of a young lady at our church who had wanted to adopt a baby for many years. She lost many, had many miscarriages. And anyway, it's a long story, but there was a woman in prison who was having a baby, and this friend of mine at church adopted that baby. Well, I was visiting the woman in prison and able to walk through that process with her. But what it did was, and this was shortly after I retired, and I think I was still wearing a wig. I was still getting done with my cancer treatments. But I thought, I looked around. I thought, there's a lot of young women here. The kids come to visit. They don't seem to know what to do with it. I went to the lieutenant. I said, I'll teach a class here, And so anyway, through a huge process you have to go through and to be approved and all. So because that little approachableness led me to an amazing ministry that I've been in for several years now in women's prison. And so, that's my senior years. But I'm a teacher by trade, shall we say. There's lots of ways to use it. You have to be paid for everything we do. So I think being approachable is very... seniors also need to listen, because God's going to surprise you what he's going to do with your life. And it can be wonderful. I have beautiful surprises in my life that I've seen. I'm looking at a friend of mine over here, Edna, and she's not quite a senior yet. She'll never be. But the thing that's so fun about being her friend is she has a gift of looking at what I call junk and thinking, this is really sellable. We can really do something with this. And she can organize the best garage sale and make money for scholarships than anybody I know. Now, I just do what she tells me to do, because I'm not very good at making those decisions. But it's a gift, and she will always do that. I know whether she's retired or not. So just think about, what do I do? How can I make my life useful in some way? I think ministers to seniors need knowledge of appropriateness of that age group, that season of life, so they don't burn themselves out trying to do something that's just not going to be helpful. And that's what we need to do. So Ed's going to say something about this now.
Okay, well, as we look at some theological reflections, you think of heroes of faith and how they served well into their older years. You think of Abraham, the nation of Israel, father of God's people. You think of Moses and his life career and leading the Israelites out of Egyptian bondage. Things messed up and he didn't get to go in, but Joshua and Caleb did. And Joshua and Caleb served into their older years. We think of David, and what a great worshiper, what a great king, what a great mess up. And yet God still used him tremendously. If we look at our mission, I'd like us to reflect for a few moments on Psalm 92. How many of you heard Terry Rush last night? What a great message, because when we read this passage, the righteous will flourish like a palm tree. They will grow like a cedar of Lebanon. Planted in the house of the Lord, they will flourish in the courts of our God. They will still bear fruit in old age. They will stay fresh and green. And what Terry had to say last night was this sense in which if we simply show up, as Susan was just mentioning, it's amazing what God will do and what kind of opportunities will come our way. So they will stay fresh and green, proclaiming the Lord is upright, he is my rock, and there is no wickedness in him. I will come and proclaim your mighty acts, Psalm 71. O sovereign Lord, I will proclaim your righteousness, yours alone, since my youth. O God, you have taught me, and to this day I declare your marvelous deeds. I'm not sure exactly what age the psalmist was at this point, but he said, even when I am old and gray, Do not forsake me, O God, till I declare your power to the next generation, your might to all who come. There's our mission statement, to be engaged, to live fully until we're called to heaven. But to live fully and be engaged. And what I love so much about what Terry shared with us last night is this idea that we keep our eyes open and we just show up each day, and it's amazing what God will show us to do. So we're about, in senior ministry or older adult ministry, we're about helping people with their faith work, with their faith engage, with their faith do, and we'll be walking that out and what it may look like in your church as well. Again, think of Simeon and Anna. Go to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2, verses 25 through 38. And we see the seniors got the honor, if you will, of welcoming and announcing the Lord's Christ. Not the young folks, not the, you know, media ministry, as if there were one, but it was the seniors. Think of Simeon. He provided a blessing. Anna, who gave thanks and worshiped. We think of them as pillars of faith in the community, daily involvement in the temple, and they were the ones who were looking for the Lord's Christ. Let's go academic on you for just a few brief moments. I know it's after lunch, so we're not going to spend much time on this. But the idea that when we look at theories on aging, it used to be kind of a disengagement theory. And I remember my grandfather, and I had great grandparents who were great role models, how to age and be green and bear fruit even in their old age. But this disengagement theory, withdrawing, a sense of which in ministry we would care for seniors. And there was a wonderful presentation last year on caring for frail seniors, and that's a very important piece to do, and I know some of you are interested in that as part of a seniors ministry, in caring for people who cannot any longer care for themselves. But that's kind of this disengagement theory, and it's this ministry to seniors. It's more of a unidirectional focus. Well, we also have the idea of kind of an emerging activity theory when it comes to seniors. And so this is more of a bidirectional focus, where there's ministry from seniors and with seniors, as well as the to and the caring for. So there's really a focus that what will be healthier in our churches is an intergenerational focus. That kind of intergenerational focus fits in the activity theory, but even that has now been eclipsed to more of a purposeful aging theory. And here we're looking at people having their identity, and that's not really changing. It's just continuing to morph and to mushroom, if you will. When we look at purposeful aging, we're looking at a sense of worth, that people have value, they have talents to contribute, they can meet challenges in their world, and so instead of becoming inept, they've got wisdom, they've got experience. And so what we want to help them do is enjoy their intimate relationships, develop new intimate relationships in which they are caring and engaging with others. One of the other things that it's pretty impressive, as much as the boomers, we tend to be narcissistic and it's all about us and we're focused about kind of that me generation type of thing, there is an emerging sense of a contemplative life, reflecting and then serving others. In fact, there was an AARP study a few years back, and it talked about 54% of boomers see themselves engaging in some kind of community service beyond themselves. And that's something that I think that we in the church, we can be tapping into. So when we look at, instead of disengagement to activity, but becoming more purposeful in our theories of aging, that helps us as we begin to understand and respect elders. So, Susan, come again and join us here on what we want to do in calling seniors to something besides just being old.
And this will be kind of a longer part here, a lot of examples. Some people came in. Did you all get books? The ones that I guess offer away. Okay, just sure everybody's equipped here. Sometimes I feel kind of marginalized as a senior, particularly a senior woman. And I think, and I'm not complaining necessarily, I'm just saying it's our culture a little bit when I think about that. It is our current culture. But sometimes they want me to serve them, but they don't necessarily want to hear from me. And I know that. I sense that sometimes. I'm real good. They want to, you know, they want me to do things, but they don't want to hear what I have to think about. And so do some of you feel like that sometimes? Yeah. And so, okay. The people at church, the leaders at church, my church community sometimes, I think I'm respected, and I'm not saying that, but I mean, sometimes if I express something, I feel like that little bit of that eyeball, like, oh, she's just old and she doesn't know and she's hampering our progress. Okay? Yes, sir?
Have you heard someone say, but this is 19?
Oh, yeah, whatever, of course. Or 20, yes. This is, yeah, oh, yes, yeah. And so I did it. And we'll look at that. But, yeah, the point is understanding that's, they're aware of that. They're aware that you want them to work, but you don't want them to have any say in anything because they're old and they don't really understand, quote unquote, I'm saying. But yeah, so think about those feelings that seniors get sometimes. And anyway, I'll kind of delve into that a little bit. But sometimes to call, yes, sir, please.
Do you get any resentment feedback from like your younger generation saying, yeah, you built the building, and so you think you have all the say and that sort of thing? And so there's kind of the pushback from the younger generation saying, we want to break away off the coattails in one sense. And then in the other sense, yes, I would love to respect and garner what wisdom I could from the older generation. There's this sort of give and take, this sort of tension.
There is, and I think a lot of that for me, now I worship here on campus. I'd like to have a church building, so we don't have that problem. But I'm sure some of you here who have buildings do. Although I do remember the church building when I grew up as basically a child in my teenage college years, and I loved it. And a group came in and really kind of took it away. Mm-hmm. And that really hurt me. Still to this day, it's like, I don't know. It's just like it was a building, but it was my home. It was my history. It was my, and it was also where my father, in this case, he was an elder there and all, worked hard to raise the money to do that. So I think these are excellent questions, because part of it is, what are we attached to? Is it the money in the building, or is it like, how am I needed now and it might not be that way? But as I say, sometimes I'm we and sometimes it's them. As I talk about this, because it's kind of both. I think, so how am I behaving? And then I wish they would change. And so I think, especially as we maybe look a little further in how they think, it's going to help you. And I like these questions because it means you're applying it. You're thinking, oh, how are they feeling? I saw another hand. Yes, Cal.
It seems like part of the challenge would be not only addressing those that are in that senior category and whatever, but it's also the younger ones, like we were talking about the building thing here.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm glad
there's a mutual kind of
reading.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you brought up the question. Or the statement.
Yeah, you sure.
But it's that the challenge is the mutual respect and relationship with one another.
And if we're not intergenerational in our ministries, then we tend to divide. Well, we paid for this building. Well, yeah, but we're giving the building life. What is a good building if you don't have people in it? And so when people don't know each other, they polarize when they're not engaged with each other. When we don't create opportunities for intergenerational relationships, then you have exactly what Ryan and what you are bringing up, that polarization.
And that's right. I remember one of my husbands saying that my daughter quotes sometimes is, if you ever have a situation or a problem, never burn the relationship. Mm-hmm. Always keep the bridge, no matter what. Whether your children, your grandchildren, someone at church, whatever, keep that. Don't burn that bridge, because you need that relationship. And the bridges go both ways with that. And thinking about it. I mean, seniors need to hear that. It's not just for them. It's they're, we're part of the problem, too. And that's why we need to think about how are we behaving. Yes, sir?
My daughter told me something when she was in high school. Uh-huh. A relationship's like a steak. If you burn it, everything gets tough.
I love it. That's wonderful. And so I love the fact that we're talking about the fact that it is a relationship, really. It's not them and us, or old or young, or boomers or builders or whatever. I think we need to know that as far as what the thinking, because sometimes I'm like, how do you think that, or where does that come from? And I kind of blink my eyes, you know, but then I think, okay, tell me more about this, because I need to understand where your thinking comes from. As I said, I have a lot of grandchildren, and they, you know, keep me young, I guess, in some ways, because I talk to them, and I want to know how they're thinking, and I'm surrounded by college students all the time, so I don't know, but I think it does, and so is Ed. I love the fact that I still like to listen to, you know, how did you reach that, or where did that come from? And I think sometimes maybe they forget how old I am because I have a relationship with them. Does that make sense? You were going to say something.
So ageism is real in a larger society?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when we look at this, you know, we say something's old. Usually that's not compliment, or, you know, it's like old school, old hymn book, old thinking or whatever. But young, you know, that's a good thing. Yeah, but you're all older than you were yesterday.
What does old hat mean?
That's right.
What's old hat mean?
Old hat. Smash. I don't know. But I think that if we have the attitude, old and young, that we don't regret going older. It is what it is. And, you know, I've thought about this recently. I thought it is a privilege to be able to grow older. And my husband didn't have that privilege. You know? And so don't regret it. Don't think it's a bad thing that I think that's happening to you. So that's why it's important to understand. I want to read something to you. Get my glasses out so I can see it. But some of you may be familiar with the author Francine Rivers. I don't know if you are, but she writes some interesting things. This particular was just a novel, but it was really about a mother and father, mother and daughter who were pretty estranged. And the granddaughter didn't have a relationship with her grandmother at all. She wanted one. She was this very sweet girl when I find my place here. So she found her grandmother and started a relationship with her and wanted her grandmother to understand the Lord more. She knew her grandmother used to, but wasn't now. And so in a conversation, and I thought this was kind of revealing, and this is what the grandmother was saying here. So listen, when you hear this, think about what issues was this grandmother dealing with and why maybe was church kind of becoming a negative to her. She said, the last time Leota had come to church, she'd been so tired and depressed, she'd known it was her last time attending church. Old age and its limitations had caught up with her. The walk to the bus stop had been fatiguing. The wait had been stressful, especially when several young hoodlums eyed her purse, seemingly waiting for possible witnesses to walk away and leave her vulnerable. Luckily, the bus had arrived before she was mugged. The ride had gone smoothly, but she arrived. The time she reached the church, she had been in dire need of using the restroom, which was downstairs. Two or three steps were easy enough to manage, but a flight of stairs and a narrow, curving passageway was risky. She had been bumped several times by children racing down to Sunday school. Holding tightly to the railing, she'd move slowly, afraid of falling or breaking bones. The younger, more able-bodied folks had to squeeze around her. By the time she went down the stairs into the restroom and back up the stairs to the sanctuary, she was exhausted. She sat in the back of the church, distressed and unnoticed, barely able to hear the sermon. In her sad state, the service had passed in a blur. All she could think about was the long journey home. How long would she have to wait for the bus? Who might be waiting at the bus stop to threaten her? She'd been so tired at that point, she sat fearful of how she would make the four-block walk on the flat section before coming to the hill on which her little house was built. It had all been too much for her. Life was stressful enough without adding to it. After that day, she hadn't gone back to church. The first few Sundays she stayed home, she tried to console herself with services on television. Surely the Lord wouldn't mind. Yet breaking the long habit of attending church every Sunday had been heart-wrenching. And what a lonely proposition those television evangelists were. with their dramatic presentations, professional singers, glitzy environments, and guilt-ridden appeals for money. They made her feel so bad at times that she thought about sending a big chunk of her Social Security check. Instead, she turned off the television. The saddest part was that no one missed her. She'd been attending the same church for years, and when she stopped going, not one person called to find out why. She supposed if she'd been more involved, perhaps her absence would have been more noticed. As it was, she hadn't been involved much. When she'd left, no one cared. For time, she had met God in the garden, and then that precious time had stripped away as well. She wondered if there was the same God as it had been when she was at church. God certainly didn't need her. With all the thousands out there serving him mightily, what did one uncommitted little old lady matter? She stopped speaking to God for a while. Then she started in again. Whom else could she talk to on a long, lonely day? And that's, you know, that's the life of a lot of these seniors. And I think for us to understand a Leota, shall we say, in our life and what she's experiencing to get there and back when she's there, how difficult it is to maneuver what's there for her. So this is kind of a failure to thrive syndrome for seniors when you look at what she was experiencing and the issues. She had to be separated from the familiar, the way that she wanted to worship in that time. So think about what are some issues she was dealing with and what she was missing and why this was happening to her in this life. And, you know, I don't think it's only technology that's changing rapidly, but how we do church is changing. And it will always change. And because of that, I think those changes have to be handled with love and understanding, because if not, it's going to accelerate miscommunication between these very people who love the Lord, who want to give and serve, but they need to, I think, have a conversation about the changes. Don't just assume they're against everything. Sometimes they just need to know why or where's this coming from. I remember a certain change that happened once. I thought, how come all of a sudden that was wrong and now all of a sudden it's right? I needed a conversation between, you know, but the young got that conversation. The older one, you know, suck it up, lady, and this is what it is in this new. But I felt a little like, you know, I kind of wanted to be a part of that conversation. I saw a hand, sir.
But so you're saying that there is, so that methods, okay, not necessarily doctrine per se, mm-hmm. but methods would change. And that's okay mm-hmm. so long as we have the we communicate about yeah. it, we can agree upon that, we
yeah.
can come to a
yeah.
understanding of that. The conflict mm-hmm. comes when there's not the communication.
Yeah, and not even the respect for that. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, sometimes it wasn't even, I just kind of, so what you got from here to here, like I would tell parents of college kids who are here, the college kids, I'd say, if you're thinking about doing something, tell your parents along the way, I'm thinking about maybe changing my major. I'm thinking about maybe going to London. I'm thinking about. So then when you make the decision, your parents kind of coming along a little bit on the journey instead of calling them one day and saying, guess what? I quit school. I'm going to do this. You know, talk with them along the way. And then when you get to that point, people are more likely to say, oh, I get it. Oh, okay. You know, a little bit more. And so I think respect that for any age. But yes, I think it may be doctrinal to them. You can define that the way you want to. But for me, some of it, I just thought, well, might not be my choice. It might not be the way I would choose to do it. But, you know, it's not wrong. And this is where I am. And so I'm going to go along with that. I'm not a troublemaker. But I like the respect of being informed of why, instead of just getting out and making an announcement. All of a sudden we're going to do this. Oh, we are. Does that make sense to you, especially for seniors? They need to be brought along. Like everybody does, I guess. Do you have a hand back there, Norm? Oh, no. Okay, I thought you were raising. So think about it. They want to feel comfortable asking questions, making suggestions, requesting help without feeling they're a problem or a burden or wrong, because that's the feeling. hopefully many of you here are not senior citizens, which I can see, which is wonderful, for you to understand that if you're going to be a youth minister, my guess is, I hope, you study adolescent psychology or understand youth. So if you want to understand seniors, that means you need to maybe delve into their world a little bit and try to figure out, you know, what it's about. Yet we're probably the least considered in church plans, maybe for several reasons. Fear of working with the aging, kind of not knowing what to do with us, maybe minimalizing our needs, a historical preoccupation with youth ministry. And I love youth ministry, let me tell you, it's not that, but we have a historical preoccupation, I think, with that. Maybe lack of curricular materials or materials and understanding youth in a sense that adults kind of don't need spiritual development. I have a house group in my home every Tuesday night, about 20 college students, and that's great fun. I feed them, so that's probably why they come. But I also love to talk with them and hear how they're thinking and what's going on. So I told them I was going to be teaching this class, and I said, so what do you think of old people? What's an old person to you? What, tell me, you know, talk to me about that or write it down or whatever. So I got a lot of interesting things, I think, from them. Some say when I visit some churches and it's a bunch of old people, that's how they say it, a bunch of old people. I'm kind of uncomfortable. I don't know what to do with, like, walkers or with wheelchairs, and so I just can't relate to the age or their music or whatever. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, who do you think I am? But again, I think they don't quite see that as much because I'm more of a part of their group, shall we say, in some ways. Or one said, I like young churches because old people scare me. I don't want to lose my passion for the Lord. I needed to hear that. You know, and so we think about, okay, so with this multi-generational in our churches, we need to witness passion for the Lord. They want to hear that, and I think they do. And when they see that, then they're kind of okay, I think, with that. As it said, ageism is real, and not just sexual or political or racialism. It's ageism. Jesus taught us not to fear those who could kill our bodies, rather to fear those who could kill both body and soul. That's from Matthew 10:28. My guess is that the younger people actually appreciate us when they get to know us in that and are part of our world. It's neither, I think, helpful nor realistic to compare. You know, when we hear about seniors, and I think this could be good, but when you compare most senior citizens to those unique seniors swim the English Channel at 70 or climb Mount Everest at 75 or run a marathon at 84, that's fine. But then you're sitting there like, whoa, I'm just such a failure as a senior citizen, because that's an anomaly, really, when you think about it. I think, though, that running a faithful life with a faithful family until death is a marathon worth acknowledging. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to acknowledge that with our longevity people. However, I think it's important to remember that the elderly people are still seeking the gospel. I have lots of friends all over the world, but I have a missionary friend in Japan that I correspond with a lot. And he wrote something that, just briefly, that he said in this email that I guess in Japan they have the same kind of considerations that we do. He said, Japan is the fastest aging population of any country in the world. What do lonely, elderly people do? He said, last week, an elderly person jumped in front of the train down by the station where we cross the tracks. Elderly people here often have no family to care for them. They often live alone, and their pensions do not pay for their health insurance or the utilities. And some are starving in one of the richest countries of the world, he said. And that's why he and his ministry works in retirement homes, what they call old folks' home because he realizes they're not dispensable. They're people that, I know Mary Ellen works in one of those places, and I love people who do that. My mother was there, and it's just wonderful to have someone like that, and you know what joy she must bring when she walks even in the door there. So remember, the gospel is for all, And it's elderly people, too. We have a lot of immigrants coming into our country and our towns. And with that, it certainly is an aging population. But we want to do good works, and I believe in that. We want to feed the hungry and give clean water and all of that. But if we do that and they don't know Jesus, what have we really accomplished with that? We've helped their bodies, but not their souls. And I think that's important. He was mentioning intergenerational ministry. I don't know if you've looked at this book. It's fairly recent, although it's really a doctoral dissertation put in a book, so you kind of have to read through it. But it's called Intergenerational Christian Formation. It's by Holly Allen and Christine Ross. But I was able to glean some really, I think, good and helpful things, and this is also on your resource list that you have there. So just briefly, in looking at that book, she says, spending time together with all ages helps us to understand and respect each other. You see, if they don't know us and we don't know them, how can we do that? How can we understand and respect each other? It makes us want to know them better and want to take care of them, she said. She mentions that churches who have more intergenerational groups, that may be small groups, it may be Bible study groups, it may be committees, whatever it is, she said, they seek to understand different styles of worship much better because they've kind of talked about it in the small group. When an elderly person dies, she said, everyone, including children and teens, go to the funeral. It's not just the elderly that are at that funeral, because the children and the teens know that person and care about that person. What a beautiful thought, at least for me. I thought, well, I'll probably get close to that stage of my life. Wouldn't it be nice if some younger people cared about that? And that she said they tend to share and work better together in ministry when they've had some intergenerational work. I think, so we need to think about it, that in our churches. I think of where my son worships, it's what I guess you'd call a smaller church, and he has three daughters, and I just love, those girls walk in that door, and everybody knows who they are, and those girls feel needed there, because it's small, and they know they're needed. So my 14 and 16-year-old granddaughters are teaching classes, and they, because they feel needed. But also, there's a wonderful couple there. One of the church leaders, he is an African-American couple. In fact, I went to school with him. John McCartney, you know who it is. And they just reach out to my granddaughters. My granddaughters love them. And I love watching that relationship. What a blessing. You don't need to have a mega church to do that. And it's very intergenerational. I'm so thankful for that. Anyway, she has lots of resources there. The other thing that I was asking with my house group about this, about older people, they said that sometimes seniors to them are hard to approach. And I thought, see, we need to listen to the other side. You know, are you hard? Are we hard to approach? They would love to hear more of our stories, they said. They would like to have more mentors. So maybe we're missing an opportunity there that we've never really pursued because maybe we don't know we're needed or wanted without. And they also said, though, that when they give an opinion, they feel like seniors disregard their opinion. So I thought, well, okay, we all need to listen to, you know, do we do that? They said sometimes they're very blunt and disrespectful. Yeah, and that's probably true. You know, so we think about that. And one said, I just love these, one said they smell like lavender and cats, and she's afraid if she hugs them, they might break. But interestingly enough, I think that at church recently, it's funny, I was going to make an announcement about missions, so I sat toward the front where the youth group sits. And after church, I enjoyed listening to them sing behind me. I just loved that. And one of them said, oh, I know you. You're the ice cream lady. And what it meant was they go on hikes and they come by my house and have ice cream sundaes. That's simple. That's intergenerational. I'm the ice cream lady, I guess. You know. So that's what they know. Edna.
I have an example.
Oh, good.
Talking about just being blunt. We recently downsized, and there's a lot of, I guess, a little more seniors. The lady that lives next door, and she when I was quite a bit older, and she lives alone, and her whole family lives out of the state.
Uh-huh.
So we moved in. I went, "Hi, how are you doing?" And she said, "Okay." She was a, and then I came in one other time, and I saw her, and I said, "How are you? It's a beautiful day out today, uh-huh. you know." And she says, "You work all the time."
Oh, yeah. And I was, so she's watching.
I don't know, I was just being light. And she said, "You work all the time."
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I said, "Oh, yeah." And she said, "I was really hoping that whoever moved in would be here."
Mm-hmm.
And I just like that.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, you can give me a couple of years, and I think I'll be home."
But
it was just,
more.
It was just so flat and blunt.
That's true. That's how they say it.
I didn't even
we
know
don't
how
know.
To...
Yeah.
Come back.
Yeah.
I just was like stunned.
Because she was yearning maybe for someone that
she
didn't
was,
want to work every day.
Just the way she said it to me felt.
I know. It
felt hard.
How
do
you say it?
You know.
Yeah.
I'll be with her a couple of times a week. She'll love you.
I know. And I'm going to reach out, but it just was like, it was taken back.
You know, and with this, I think that some of the studies I've read recently says that for our seniors, it requires unlearning and rethinking. You know, that's our challenge, I think, at least mine. You know, I have to unlearn, and this is what I thought I knew, and I need to rethink that, I need to reevaluate that, I need to regurgitate that a little bit, and that may be a challenge for us.
Can you give us an example of unlearning something?
Well, I think in the context that we're talking about here, I think for me, let's say at church, they decide to do something that I never did growing up, and it may be the role of women or something like that. I'm like, and so me, I had to, I don't know if I unlearned it well, but I tried to rethink it, I guess, rather than just dismissing it or not coming to church anymore or whatever. That's just an issue of how to kind of unlearn. But for me, it needed to be processed more than it wasn't processed at all. And so, so that's unlearning. Or maybe it even be, Ed's here with the computer and all that. Now, I can do that kind of, sort of. I'm kind of okay. But then as soon as I learn it, they give me another system, and then I have to unlearn that one and relearn that one. And that gets a little tiring for me, and the young ones are like, "Cool, yeah." And I'm like, "I missed it. I knew how to do it. I'm fine. You don't need to change it for me." But that's, I think, what I mean by sometimes we have to kind of rethink how we used to think about that or unlearn that and learn another way, at which we've done maybe in a lot of ways, I think, you know, in our churches. This is something I was thinking about the other day, and I think this is what seniors want to say. They want to say, "Please be patient with me as I was with you when you were a child. You were slow then. You selectively forgot things. You got sick and needed care. You had to be taught new things. You rambled on about your day and wanted me to listen with rapt attention. You were afraid of new experiences. You wanted me to keep you company when you were lonely. And yet you wanted independence. And now I need that." And that, you know, as I was thinking about that, I think seniors, back to what we were talking about earlier, they don't want to feel like they're a burden to society or to other people. I think a little sensitive to that. And when people are busy like that or whatever, you think, "Well, I'm just getting in their way. They're busy. They don't have time for me. I'm just going to back off and not be a problem and get out of the way." And that's why they're lonely, because of the busyness of the generation, and rightfully so for their busyness. But then that's where we need to have maybe invite her to tea someday, which I know you would have beautiful teacups, Edna. And just you know, for an hour maybe, that would be a wonderful investment maybe of time with that. But they're sensitive to that. They need to be invited. They're not always going to get in your face. They want to be asked. They want to be invited. Even with your children, don't want to be in their way. So think about, am I doing that? Loneliness is certainly paramount in many of their lives, as we just read that. And understand and respect that their bodies are changing, and that this is even in doing church, think of what Leota experienced going there. Some have hearing loss, so you have to draw closer or minimize extraneous noise, use microphones. Some have difficulty with their sight, need good lighting, large print, help with driving.
some mobility issues. You need handrails. After I had chemotherapy, I've got neuropathy in my feet and a lot of stairs here in this campus, and I'm fine, as head and nose, but I need a handrail to stay, just to keep myself stable. And so those are important. Watch loose rugs, one level. You don't get that here. Some have difficulty with muscular strength. You need sturdy chairs, so when they lift to try to get up, the chair is going to hold them together with that. Some have sensitive skin, and they need it to have the same comfortable temperatures. They're still able to do lots of good things. I was even thinking this week, I don't know how it could be, but sometimes I think there ought to be parking places for people, I don't know, 70 and older or whatever you want to say. They may not be handicapped, but sometimes at church, whatever, it would be really nice to have a parking place that's maybe easier for them. So they need to feel like their lives are of value. Now we have, let's go to the next one. Okay, who are these people? who is this?
The Grinch.
And Scrooge. And when we think of the Grinch and Scrooge, what are some words we think of when we think of them?
Tight.
What?
Tight.
Tight. Tight what? Yeah, okay. Grouchy.
Stingy.
Stingy. Stingy.
Unapproachable.
Yeah, unapproachable.
Bitter.
Bitter.
Greedy.
Greedy.
Self-centered.
Yeah. Mean. That's right, Ben. Mean.
Oh.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Especially. And those are, and you're right, those are words we think of when we see your Scrooge or Grinch, whatever. But at the end of the story for them, stay on their picture for a minute. Yeah. Okay. At the end of the story for them, what were they?
Nice.
Converted.
Generous.
They changed.
Converted.
Yeah. So we think, you know, in our lives, I'm certainly not recommending you be Scrooge, but sometimes the end of the story is different than the beginning of the story. And for older people sometimes, let's say, they want to be remembered in the opposite. They want to be remembered for the vital, good, strong life they lived. And maybe their last years, they're sick or they have dementia or they're not able to serve as well or do as well. They don't want to be remembered just for that. Mm-hmm. Remember the last 80 years. We sometimes dismiss all of that. I've been to several funerals that John has done. Beautiful, because he remembers their lives when it was like that. And so with them, you think the opposite a little bit. Are we a Grinch or a Scrooge when we could do that? So anyway, the stories, yeah. Listen to their stories. I think for some of you may work with youth or young people or have grandkids or have young people around. Listen to their stories. If you go to their home, maybe have your ask a story. I just brought it. I just brought something here. Sometimes there's something in your home that they're saying, why does she keep that old thing anyway? You know, what's that? Just Edna might find a treasure out of this. But, you know, mm-hmm. The reason I keep it is because there's a story behind it. Mm-hmm. Something my husband bought in Sapporo when I was expecting our daughter. We lost our first child, and I wasn't with him, and he brought this home for this baby that we didn't have yet. And I treasured this. And it's just an old wooden bear. In fact, when we were setting up, the student noticed that I had. She said, oh, and she was very interested in my bear. It was really fun. I was setting it down. So there may be things in their home you might say, is there a story behind this? Tell me the story. Or have the youth group talk to them about their stories, their lives, what they have there. I think that will bring them a lot of joy. And then lastly, and I know this is a long area, but it's an area of understanding, getting into the heart of there, what this is about. Louis Cozzolino, he's a professor at our graduate school of education and psychology. He's been studying what's called the healthy aging brain. So I love to read anything he's writing since I've got an aging brain, and I hope it's healthy. So I want to quote just briefly here from his work. He said, another window into our deep history is in the way elders and children relate to stories. It's always been the job of elders to tell stories, passing them on to the younger members of the tribe. most of us have older relatives who tell the same story again and again as if we've never heard it before. I think I probably do that, but there's 16 of us, and I think, did I tell you that or not? I wonder which one of you. So sometimes we repeat ourselves. But as we grow older, we also tend to tell more stories from long ago as the distant past becomes increasingly salient with advancing age. Now, think of who likes to hear the same stories again and again and exactly the same way.
You know.
In fact, they will even correct you if you get one word or fact wrong. One of my daughters, it was Little Bobo in the Blue Jacket. Oh, my goodness. How many times I read that book? They demand that you tell them the same story every night for weeks and months before they're ready to move on to the next one. What we're likely witnessing, he says, in these parallel processes is a genetically programmed process in both the older adult and the child to transfer stories, knowledge, and wisdom across generations. The impulse to repeatedly tell and listen to stories appears to be a lock and key mechanism of intergenerational formation transfer, which fits into the child's impulse to hear them again and again. That makes sense to you?
Yes.
You can see that. So Ed's got all kinds of stuff about there right here. Yes, sir.
You and I were classmates, by the way.
Oh, were we? Oh, Coker. Harlan Coker. Now I recognize you. We went to college together. So, okay, Harlan. Okay, that tells us how old we are. Yeah.
Okay, so
that's right.
I know a little bit about what you folks do. You and your family.
Oh, okay. You know my family.
You pass a letter around.
Yes. Oh my.
Gordon Gibney.
Yeah.
I attend church with him.
Oh, you do.
I
didn't know that.
It's a fabulous way.
You still do it. I just mailed it the other day. Yeah. It's called a round robin.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Boy, I like that idea.
It works for our generation. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's my husband was one of 8 children, and one double first cousin. And so keeping up is hard, and we do use computers, but we have his mother started a round robin letter. And so there's 9 letters, and so I take out my old one and put in a new one and keep it going. We've got a system, and it's wonderful when I get it. It's the whole story of the family. And then what I did many years ago, I thought, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I saved my letters. They're in a binder. I've got a whole family history there just from all those letters I've written. But anyway, yeah, I didn't know any of that.
Susan?
Yes.
I just going to say, when I was growing up as a little kid, and my mother would put me to bed, I was always asking her, tell me a story about when you were a little girl.
Yes.
And she'd tell me all kinds of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I learned.
And for all of you, the younger ones, nudge the young ones and say, why don't you ask grandma about this, or why don't you tell a story about that? And I'm sure you do that a lot. And I think that it's for me, I have the first granddaughter that was born after my husband died. Her name is Michaela Terry. My husband's name is Terry. And she's always saying, grandma, tell me stories about Papa Terry. And fortunately, he was a man you could tell a lot of stories about. But she wants to hear those stories, but she asks to. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yes.
Observation through years, I have been in settings where we'll call the elderly within a congregation feel it's time for them to take a back seat with the emphasis on the future is in our youth.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're promoting that kind of activity, and so there's almost a self kind of thing of it's no longer my time, it's their time, which has a tendency of building that gap. And I just thought I'd...
And just remember, that's their sensitivity. And if they're asked, you see, that'll be different. They may not interfere because they feel like they do need to take that vaccine, but they still have something good to maybe give.
There was one time at Sunset Haven where we ended up really getting into the lives of some of our residents. And a lot of the staff there, did not have grandparents in the area.
Okay, yeah.
And it was amazing to see how the relationship of just a job now change into this relationship of
great love.
Kind of care.
That's wonderful. Do you see that, Mary Ellen, with all of your work? She works in that every time.
What was it again?
It's where it's kind of like finding out the history of some of the elderly.
Things
that they've done.
Workers that maybe don't have rent.
Those that were like maybe at the during the war, the Battle of the Bulge in Normandy and things like that. And there's a lot of people, at least that I've contacted with, that have grown up without the influence, the environment of graveyards. And so what we ended up doing is setting up a kind of thing that some of the residents kind of came like, grandparents, as they had shared stories.
We're going to come around to that in a few minutes. Right after break, we're going to look at Life After 60 as a way to engage people in those storytelling conversations. We'll look at what you may be able to do in some of your church contexts and even some intergenerational contexts. How many of you, besides Dr. Free back here, are in the counseling realm? So doing counseling, psychology types of things, social work kind of things. Okay, some of you might also remember, these folks will because they had a licensure exam that included these types of things, but Eric Erickson was a well-known psychologist who looked at the eight stages of man is what he came up with, and psychological and social issues are really predominant in the human development. And so the last stage, the eighth stage, is this sense of ego integrity versus despair. And so in this stage of life, there's a sense of introspection, reflecting back, telling those stories, and realizing there's a sense of fulfillment. My life has been of value. And so if people in this psychosocial stage, psychologically, socially, are engaged in their lives, they come up with a sense of satisfaction. I haven't maybe done everything I've wanted to do in life, but it's been good. And I like my life. I like what I've done. And so if there's a failure, however, in not having those relationships and being able to reflect with some satisfaction, there may be regret, bitterness, and despair. And we've known some older folks that are stuck in bitterness. They're stuck in despair. They feel marginalized, and they let people know about it. And they talk pretty negatively about those young whippersnappers and or whatever other reverse ageism kinds of perspectives that might be occurring. Well, Eric Erickson talked about tasks. In each stage of man in development, there are certain tasks that need to be accomplished. So in this eighth stage, this ego integrity stage, he said, people need to engage in life review. And so you have in some senior citizen centers, storytelling afternoons and life review kinds of things. In some social work circles, that's one of the primary ways to bring emotional health to seniors is being able to engage in life review. We're going to come back to that in a minute. But with this sense of unity about self, my relationships with others, looking back with a sense of I've learned some things in life, I've got some wisdom, I've got some confidence about what I've done. It's this sense in which we want to keep learning in life. And so when we look at the older adult years, and you know whether it's boomers or builders or beyond, there's something we need to keep looking forward to and redirecting energies and learning new things. We'll come back to that in our Life After 60s conversation guide. Giving and receiving love is important at every stage in life. It's part of our humanness. It's part of being made in the image of God. We're in His image. We're in community. You think of the Trinity as being the beginning of community. And then Adam and Eve in the garden and their relationship. And then the brokenness with sin entering the world. But it's very important that we give and that we receive love. And one of the things that I have widows who I talk with complain about, I don't get hugged near as much as I did when I was married. And sometimes, as you said, you know, younger folks, I'm afraid I'm going to break them. There's a favorite senior lady in my life that I hug very gently, but I always make it a point to hug her very gently and hold her, because touch is so important. And it's not just receiving it, it's also having opportunities to give it. So we need to be looking at those intergenerational opportunities in our church, whether that's mentoring, adopt a grandchild or a grandparent kind of programming. But Erickson would talk about having trust, having assurance about the meaningfulness of your life, and then when you're looking at the meaning of your life, also realizing there are some physical challenges of aging. And Susan was referring to those a few minutes ago. We need to live in the present, but we also need to appreciate the past. And this is that active aging theory that we were talking about a few minutes ago. We need to live in the present, but we can't forget our past. And if people don't know our past, then we're marginalized. And so that's where our storytelling is so important. When my mom died, quite by surprise, she had been in reasonably good health, though she dealt with a chronic issue of rheumatoid arthritis. But she died rather suddenly, unexpectedly. We long expected, and my dad said, you know, he was going to die before mom. He just had it planned because, you know, he'd had heart trouble for nearly 40 years. And so when mom would talk about life, she would be saying, you know, when I'm 120 years old, because she expected to live that age. She had things to do. She was an encourager. She was into genealogy research. She just blossomed in her senior years with her genealogy research. It filled out a bookshelf wall from Susan to me. It was incredible what she generated. It's been adopted into several libraries back in Middle Tennessee now. But anyway, she had this longevity perspective about death. My dad had a shorter perspective about death. And what's interesting, though she would never talk about dying, she was always active, was interesting when she died and Dad then was alone for several years, he was very comfortable about talking about Jesus and going on to be with Mom, and he couldn't wait for the day. And in some of his dementia, in later stages of Parkinson's, he would talk about seeing Mom and Jesus at night at the foot of the bed. What a sweet perspective. Do you think I argued with that?
No.
I said, Dad, next time you see Mom, would you tell her hello for me? And Jesus, too, for that matter. But Dad had a perspective of death that was very heaven-bound, that was very theological. You know, here's the counselor. You know, we're supposed to be able to talk about death and sex and everything else that people oftentimes avoid. And I'm kind of going, Dad's talking about death again. But I know I'm a good son and a good counselor. I'm going to hang in here and listen. But I must say, my dad had a better theological acceptance, if you will, of his terminal state. Question?
Well, I have kind of a question, but do you have any advice about helping someone develop a perspective on death when they have a negative kind of view on it, and then perhaps they're just kind of dwelling on it?
Yes. Listen. Listen a lot. And find out the story of their life, and it will begin to make sense, whatever it is that you don't understand. And so ask them questions. Ask them open-ended questions. Don't try to change them. You'll get resistance. But if you care enough to listen, and you may have to listen over a period of hours, over multiple times, to finally get to understand the context of their life, and then it'll make perfect sense, and it will be easy to embrace them and help them with whatever they're afraid of about death, and that they're in denial about, or that they're afraid of.
It's hard when they, when you know that they know the scriptures and they know that what is supposed to happen when their spouse passed away, that she's going to have a new body, but then they're very protective of her body that she left behind, and they're very concerned. And,
yeah.
And so it seems to be kind of a knowing versus doing.
It's a knowing versus doing, and then it's also just simply hearing them tell their stories. And you'll know a lot better how to address their needs when you've listened to those stories. And then certainly in this last Eric Erickson stage of life, we need to give to others. As Susan was talking, seniors want to be of value. They want to be valued and want to be important. And so we've got to find ways that they can serve each other. Even as frail seniors, they may be able to read to someone who is more frail than they and can no longer read. But whatever the level of senior activity and mobility and physical abilities are, we need to help them find purpose and the ability to serve other people. Well, we're going to come to mobilizing here because that's a major part of our workshop. We certainly want to have respecting and the serving perspective, engaging our seniors, but we want to be into mobilizing and looking at how do we establish ministries in our churches, no matter what size. We're going to take a break in just a couple of moments, but we have to ask the question, do we copy somebody else's ministry style? You know, in Christian circles, we're really good about copying things. We put it on the Xerox photographic, you know, we just keep on. And yet, maybe that's not the best thing for us, because there's some types of senior ministries that really are social in nature. And so it's about luncheons, it's about trips, it's about activities. It's more like a travel bureau within the church. And there's certainly an important part of that. Other churches may be really into a service mode. Caring for the frail might be repairs, might be a transportation ministry or Meals on Wheels, children, music. We've got a handout for you that gives a lot of suggestions for what senior ministries can do. But oftentimes, they'll see it as, here's a service that we want to engage in. And then there's certainly types of senior ministries that really focus more on the spiritual and leave some of the other issues beside. So it may be World Bible School grading. It may be focus on worship. It may be taking communion to shut-ins, Bible studies, retreats. And so when I talked with Susan about this a year ago, one of my tasks in this was, let's find the top three ministries and the formats, and let's, you know, have something to recommend to you. With a little research and then running across a community asset-based approach, I don't have the way that you should roll out a senior ministry in your church of 150 or 600 or 1,000 or whatever. Because what you need to do is look at, with a prayer and brainstorming session, what do you want to do? What are the talents that already exist in your group? That's the asset-based approach to establishing what you want to do in your senior ministry. So what assets do you have in addition to people? I know there's one church in Nashville that was well known for their benevolence ministry. When they added onto their building, they actually added a workshop. It became kind of the guys' club. They had woodworking equipment. They had repairs, wood workbenches. And they were in a repair ministry. And they would fix up broken items. They would sell those. They would take care of widows and something breaks in their house, and it was kind of the guys' club and their service ministry, and so they had part of their building dedicated to that. Not many churches have done that, but that's pretty cool. I have a friend here in Southern California, and it's his workshop, his business that is in a retirement kind of declining stage, but he's kept the lease on the place, and they have all kind of tools. And it is kind of like a guys' club. They get together and they build things. So what assets do you have in the way of buildings or transportation or other things besides the talents of your people? One of the things I would encourage you to do, start with one or two efforts that flow naturally out of the talents that people in your group already have, that already have a passion for that. And so when we facilitate leadership structure, we do it around the natural talents. And you may have people in your group that have been leaders in an agency, a business, in their community. And they may not be an elder in your church, but they have leadership capabilities. And so look again for the natural leadership that just kind of surfaces even in that brainstorming session, and the talents that you know that they've enjoyed in their life. Also, engage your church leadership, and yet don't just expect your church leadership to do this for you. One of the things that if you're really going to respect seniors, give them the respect of self-determination, if you will. Don't tell them what to do. Allow them to figure that out for themselves. Again, that's part of that Eric Erickson wisdom, that confidence in your life. You can figure out some things. In fact, maybe more important, as you engage church leadership, the wisest church leaders know when to get out of the way and bless people and charge them with the development of what they need to do. So you may be on the church leadership side of things, or you may be in the, I want to do something here in my church. Well, talk with your church leadership, but don't ask them, quote, for money and budget or a seniors minister. Don't create barriers. Say, these are talents we've got. We're already doing some of these things. We'd like to have your blessing on this, and run with it. But start with one or two efforts and build on those successes. Also, take a look at some advantages versus disadvantages over copying another person's ministry. This is not staff driven, so you don't have to hire somebody. You don't have to increase budget tremendously. It can be very much a volunteerism kind of effort. When people volunteer and they put in their idea and their time and they own it, the involvement goes up and the energy goes up tremendously. In fact, the fit becomes better for your church. And so maybe you're in Sun City, Arizona, and you have retirement communities, and you have community rooms in some of the retirement communities, and they've got natural places outside the building to engage people who are unchurched. You don't want to bring that ministry under the church and have everybody come there on Tuesday mornings for coffee and conversation. You want to do that in multiple locations in those retirement communities. You're going to find the better fit for your context if you listen to the people in your group. Well, disadvantages is, you know, that ministry is going to need to morph. You can't just say, here's the plan and impose it, or here's the greatest book on ministry, like we say youth ministry, well, here's older adults ministry. What we're going to do is let that morph depending on what members' talents are. So you're going to have, if you come back next year and talk with each other here at Pepperdine Bible Lectures, you're going to be able to say, well, our group did this and our group did this. May inspire each other with your stories, but it's going to fit your context much better that way. But it's going to need to morph rather than being a package deal, ready to sell, ready to go. Also, when you're dealing with volunteers, there is some inconsistency, right? Well, can you tolerate that? How many... comment earlier as we were beginning our presentation about, you know, being in control of things. Well, maybe in ministry we need to be less about being in control of things and just let them roll. But with that, you do come the risk that people aren't always going to maybe do their job the way you expect them to. And yet, who of us does anything in a high control, high perfection way, unless we're going to earn one of those OCD kind of diagnoses kind of thing? And so some days, you know, it's going to be inconsistent. But can we allow people to own what they do the consistency will probably be better than if we're trying to assign things that people don't see themselves in their natural talent abilities to do. Well, let's probably take a break here, and then let's come back. Let's take about a 10-minute break, because that'll stretch.
At the most, yeah.
7 to 10 minutes. We've got water. We've got
restrooms for women.
Women that way. Men.
Okay, just restrooms.
Men that way. Women this way.
Take a handful of these and wake up a little bit, move around,
yeah.
And then what you can do is look at questions up here then now, because we probably won't have time to go through them.
Yeah, we're behind.
We're pretty good, but now we need to get the books out. Oh, just so you know, we're going to give you your books after the break.
I just have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned that the first that you I know someone that used to live in Memphis.
Yeah, just saw him a few weeks ago.
Okay,
well, he's all the time over at the grad school. In fact, he's done 3 degrees in our school.
And then we're going to go over.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we kind of grew up in the same place here. We were teenagers in Springfield, Missouri.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know this is weird, but I wrote a note to him. I thought maybe you could give it to him.
I would love to.
The other day, I told him here, the other day here at Pepperdine. Where did I say that? Down here at Pepperdine. He sang, "Be with me, Lord," which Brother Sanderson. I know he either wrote the words of the music.
His dad.
Yeah, that's his dad, Ellis. Yeah. Actually, he did the wedding ceremony. His dad. Anyway, he wrote that, and he told us how he went upstairs in his office, which is up by the balcony, in the middle of the night, and I don't know if he wrote the words or the music. And now it's like I want to know.
Did you put your phone? Good.
Okay. I did.
Good.
And
all right.
So I thought it would just be fun.
I will see him Saturday, probably.
You will?
Yeah,
great.
Graduation next week, a week away.
Great. Well, tell him.
All right. I will put it in my wallet. That way it doesn't get lost.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Yeah, it's just a little thing, but I was telling my friends about that the other day, and I thought, I can't remember the words out there, but it's a good story.
Yes, sir. No, I'm not.
She was a California senior legislator. When we were our state legislature, 40 senators and ladies of the people, which I want. We got a website.
I would love to. In fact, these have been built for community agencies, so they're not in a big way scripture-based stuff. We really wanted to get this, especially Life After 60 and caregivers. We want to get that out into community service agencies so you can help us with that.
Most of our, well, in California, I guess we're one of the active states, but the system for seniors.
Yeah.
A lot of those laws come up through this organization. This one this year is the choice of Bennett. You know, and live it out, they can sort of become a boss. And that's what we do. Give it to our legislature and try to get them turned into law, affected seniors. But check that out.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you.
Did you have a question?
No, I was just going to say to you, one of the things you made me think of when you were talking about how it is, and I understand I'm not there with you, but it's a children's book. Have you read Wilfred Gordon's
and Donald? Oh, yes, I have. I have it at home.
And I just love it. I just love it. And so I am thinking about Nancy.
She gives him things like this. And then what does that mean? This is what she gives.
Yes.
No, it's a wonderful. I have that. Yes, I love it. I read it to my. Yes. Oh, I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
She was saying how much she loves all
the people. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, I got
That's, I love it. It's perfect. It's so true.
I had to just tell
you. Oh, I'm so, yeah, no, that's true. I'm going to get myself organized here a minute. Maybe zero. I just love that section of reading there.
Yes, no, look at you. I mean, when you said that, I thought, oh, then I had to look again, yeah, like we all do. I thought, I know.
Terry was our class president.
Yeah, he was. He was student body president when we were there. He was quite a guy. We still miss him. 18 years old.
Was he about 15 years old?
57.
Okay.
He's just young.
Yeah.
Too young. But then, these are my friends. Out of the way, there are.
Yeah, please take in all those. There to see what you like. Well, I'm Paul. Are you? The reason we're sitting down is
If that's what you're listening to, the way it's set up for the church is ministry. It's just recommended questions.
Right.
So that we can help people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, so they don't do their seniors. Some of our seniors are still younger. They can be great.
Plus the fact that that's what's called cold titus.
Yeah.
I've almost never mentioned it. This is not just some high lay. This would be a good idea. We just thought of this. It is, of course, great. God got us these days.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's been from the first century. They've been saying, do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks for letting me know that you've been listening. It's kind of like casting your breath on the water.
Well, I have three, it's kind of like three levels. I've got my, I don't make it through your lecture. It's really boring. I already and then there's the, yeah, I listen to it, and I was like, oh, interesting. And then there's the ones that I listen to and I save, like, listen to someone else. And I think, I don't know if I initially saved the lectures per se, but I definitely kept up with the, that no one wanted to do this. So when I saw your name, I was like,
very much so.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Good to meet you. There
was a story running in my mind.
Briefly, we had a building program that applied to the Houston in terms of appreciating the past. What happened was, after 40 years, we were ready to have a building. And the younger people wanted to do that. And so we started meeting at the committee to try to make time. And then public statements in different places started to speak up about how this was in your car. You couldn't get a wheelchair in the bathroom. Why is it? And they were, they thought they were disparaging the building in order to set up the idea of roof.
I was insulting the folks
who built it with their hands. And I knew I could see what was going on. And I'm not very assertive, but I got assertive. And it's like remodeling a school dude in Florida. Yes. And I began to I did research on the church.
Go ahead, I was going to ask you to start passing the day.
Yeah, let's
you get the idea.
I'm so sorry. You know, I just want to And then
what's that?
You're
going to get
three.
Wow. Yeah. You're going to ask that if you're with a spouse or with several people in the same church to make sure we
support
them.
Yeah.
Okay. That, well, that, okay.
We're going to do them out one at a time.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
we need to start getting back in our seats, so here's your two-minute warning.
Oh, not even 5.
That was 2 minutes. Not 10, but 2-minute warning.
Oh, great. Did you get the folder?
There's folders right at the back in that box.
It's see the man in the blue shirt right behind him. As I say, I know we need to kind of hustle along here. I think what I'll do, well, you'll start and just kind of give him the book, turn the pages, tell him about who we are, and then I'll go through and we'll just kind of skip. However,
okay.
This happened last time. I wanted to spend a little more time on, you know, like grief and loss and some of that.
I think
I'll play with it and see how.
And they can still use the
I keep looking at that and remember.
Well, Terry.
That is not
Hargrave.
Yeah.
Terry Hargrave went to Fort Drum States.
Okay. Well, nobody seems to be interested. They will still be there.
Right.
So, okay. Because we didn't promise.
Okay. Be getting to your seats, and Susan is going to come by and hand you out a book that we're going to look at, Life After 60. And if you're here with your spouse, if you would just take one, or if you're with a congregation, like several people are together, take one booklet, and that way we'll make sure we have one for everyone.
So it's just, we're doing it.
We've done okay.
While Susan's doing that, I'm going to tell you about our helping skills handout. In your packet, because I'm a counselor, people oftentimes ask me, how do we help seniors? Like seniors have no abilities to help themselves. Yeah. So what about that? Where's that coming from? That's that unidirectional caring for seniors but not valuing the talents of seniors. So the most important thing you can do is listen to seniors. Ask open-ended questions. You'll notice in the handout on this helping skills, I didn't call it counseling skills, even though I'm a licensed professional counselor. I do believe in counseling. I think it's a great thing to do. But one of the things... Are we having a little trouble hearing in the back? Because there's some other people talking. I don't think I could get much louder. Okay, and I've been leaning into the mic a little bit. Is the mic helping you some? Okay, all right. So there is a field of counseling called solution-focused, and it's about believing that people have resources within themselves to help them with whatever challenges or difficulties in their life that they're having. And so you want people to talk about their stories, talk about when life was a certain way, what would help it to get just a little bit better. And so you're asking what's been helpful in the past when you faced something similar to this. What kind of goals, if this were to be just a little bit better tomorrow, what would you notice that you're doing? What would be small steps? What would be something specific? Something that you might notice if someone were following you around with a video camera. What would that be? Something that's measurable. What are you going to be doing when things are a little bit better? One thing we know from a lot of research on counseling is that it's not our brilliant theories about counseling that help people get well. In fact, if you look at the big blue part of this pie chart, 40% of what makes counseling work, these are studies by Lambert, by Duncan, by Miller, they've been replicated a number of times, it's actually the talents and abilities that someone has. And so client factors, their personality, their support systems, their experience, their wisdom, some of those things we were talking about, that's what's going to help them get through whatever challenge. Look at the red part of the pie chart. 30% is the therapeutic relationship that a counselor has in just caring and listening, apart from any theory, any kind of grad book kind of stuff. It's 30% the relationship. So what Susan and I are going to share with you over the next hour, the last hour of our presentation here, is how do we help mobilize seniors to care for seniors? How do we respect seniors that they've got the answers from within? How do we help them resource themselves, if you will? And a lot of that happens not only out of that 40%, their client factors, but the relationships between helpers. And that helper can be simply another senior or a younger person who engages in the stories. And then notice the bright green, the lime green, hope, or what we call the placebo effect, the fact that I'm going to be engaged in this helping relationship with this counselor or with this fellow senior, and there's a 15%, quote, helpfulness rate out of that. Now look at the yellow. 15% is the therapeutic model or theory of counseling that you may be using. So now, how useful are counselors? 15% is what the research shows comes out of some specific theory, cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic theory, solution-focused theory, whatever the theory may be, accounts for very little helpfulness. Mike Cope's colleague, Landon Saunders, in the Heartbeat Ministry, talks about radical human presence. And when I teach my grad school students in theology and counseling, I talk to them about radical human presence. That's that red part of the pie chart here. We want to engage people, give them excuses to listen to one another, to engage in radical human presence with one another. Well, that's how helping works. So what we're going to spend some time with here in three models, we're going to be looking at life after 60, we're going to look at caregivers, and we're going to look at grief and loss. And the whole idea is ministry through story. Now, how easy does that get? Getting people to tell their stories, their experiences, connecting people with one another. When you look at Galatians 6, bear one another's burdens, or you reflect back on Terry Rush's lesson last night, engage with people. So what Susan and I are going to do is help you understand, here are some models to engage people through story. And we have this sense of storytelling connecting one another in a body. And it's also about connecting one another, even those who are not inside a fellowship with one another. Connecting with your neighbors. Oftentimes people don't want to get together and study the Bible with you because you're a stranger. And so one of the things you want to do is connect people to people through story. People long for connections. Susan talked about loneliness. Eric Erickson talked about this ego integrity versus despair and the loneliness in your life. People long for relationships. So as we look at ministry through story, both in life after 60, in caregivers, and grief, when we share our story, God shows up in that story. And it's much like this graphic here of a loom where the shuttle with thread passes back and forth and back and forth, and a pattern develops. And we see the beauty of that pattern as God breaks through in our stories and what's happening. As we look at goals, we're looking for folks to share time together, not to be lonely and be isolated, but to be engaged with one another so that they can support one another, so they can enjoy a level of friendship. So we give some simple guidelines. Looks a lot like this. If you look at page 11 in your Life After 60, very simple guidelines. These are similar across the three booklets, but it looks a lot like this. Page 11, take turns. We learned this in grade school or kindergarten, take turns, share well with other, share stories, don't monopolize, give a Reader's Digest version. I get amused when Rhonda and I do marriage mentor training, and we have some younger folks in that mentor training. They don't know what Reader's Digest version is. You get it. That's right. So give a Reader's Digest version. Somebody can always ask for more information. You choose questions only at the level at which you're comfortable with sharing. This is not the Gospel Treasures or Gospel Advocate Quarterly that some of you might have grown up on in church, and somebody who really didn't have any Bible training could just kind of march through both the scriptures and the questions and the answers, you know, kind of thing. Even though it is similar in size, 6 by 9, this is just more of a freewheeling. Talk about what you want to talk about. It's not counseling, it's friendship. 5, share your experience, but you don't tell someone else what they need to do. You share your story, your wisdom, your experience. Work for me, don't know if it'll work for you. You observe boundaries so you don't push the other person to talk about questions he or she would rather pass on. You know, some people are a little more private than others. Others are going to wait till they know they can really trust one another before they'll share more deeply. You take your time. It's not like you're trying to get through all the questions in one conversation hour. In fact, in a retirement community, using this or a Tuesday morning coffee and conversation time with each other, you know, people may spend several conversation periods on a given topic. We are looking at, though this can be done in a group, the greater power is one person with another person, or at most 3 in a small group, just kind of getting to know and support and share their stories. Be a friend, not a constant companion. These are times you get together. However, as you get to know someone better in friendship, you may well be calling them more often and checking in on them. I love my aunt. And one of the things she did on her little street is even neighbors across the street, when the blinds would open in the morning, that's the signal. I'm alive. I'm okay. Blinds don't open. Your neighbors, 2, 3, that can see your blinds don't open on the front window. We are calling, and we're coming over. Anyway, friendship, caring. And then respecting partner's story. Rhonda and I talk about this in marriage mentoring. Every story told to you is like a copyrighted story. This is this person's story that they're telling. Let them own it. Let them tell it. Don't you repeat their story. You're welcome to tell your story and repeat your story all you want to whomever you want. These are guidelines. We're not using the term confidentiality because this is not counseling. This is not our wheelhouse of professional stuff. This is friendship level. So we talk about privacy. We talk about copyrighted story. That's how all 3 of these conversation guides work. So let me tell you what we're up to when we recommend in Life After 60, looking back. This fits that Eric Erickson idea of we help people look back and do life review. So your family background and where you came from, here's some sample questions if you want to flip over. There are more to have. But conversation 1, page 12. 13, rather. Where were you born and raised? What was your community like? What was your family like? What did your folks do? It's kind of getting to know one another and the background and what their childhood was like. In fact, some of our memories are a lot better about childhood than they are about last week, right? Don't go asking embarrassing questions. What did your preacher preach on last week? I know I got some preachers in the house, so, but, you know, our childhood memories stick with us a lot better. And then what traditions have been passed down among your people, in your family? What are traditions that are important to you? It helps us connect with one another when we know our past. Some sample questions about thankfulness, the next conversation. What was one of the happiest moments of your life? Or what have you learned from your past that helps you today? And again, over coffee, can you imagine those of us who are on the senior side enjoying getting to know someone? These conversation questions give us that excuse, if you will, to not only share our story, but to learn someone else's. Well, Eric Erickson and what Susan had to share about our bodies are aging. Conversation three is about health, nutrition, and wellness. I love some of the quotes that when I was doing research for this, I wanted to kind of draw people into a conversation. And I love what Leon Eldred said. If I'd known I was going to live so long, I'd have taken better care of myself. And there's some other quotes through the book. But we're trying to say, what's going on in your life? What do you do for exercise? How's your exercise changed? You know, how are you adjusting to the changes in strength or vision or dexterity? Just because you're old doesn't mean you need to shift it into park and stay home. You know, and so what do you do that helps keep you engaged and healthy and a lot of other kinds of things? My mother would say, and she was a registered dietitian, master's level trained person, but when she said, well, I'm opening up a can of corn for Dad and I for supper, and that was it, I'm kind of going, okay, Mom, what about the other food groups and what you told us growing up as kids, kind of thing. But what would a good friend say about your eating habits? Most older folks would say, I want to make sure I get my ice cream.
Eat your dessert first.
Your mother is not here watching. Well, maybe from up in heaven, but she can't do anything about it. So get your ice cream. But what would a good friend say about your eating habits? Conversation four, it's about friendship. And again, you see we've gone from looking at the past to what's going on in the present with people's lives. So friendship isn't a big thing. It's a million little things. I love that and the other quote there. Who's one of your best friends? Describe your friendship. Describe what a friend did for you when you needed help. What did you do for a friend who needed your help? And again, we're getting ministry going on because we're talking about helping one another. Kind of that Galatians 6, bearing one another's burdens, being helpful to one another. So a conversation on friendship. Current family relationships are important. It's not always peachy keen. So what changes have occurred in your family? Sometimes we're not sure if people understand what we're going through, and it may be something that's difficult. When do you have the opportunity not to have to go to a therapist, but to have somebody who cares? A friendship now that you've had at least five conversations with who will engage with you in knowing what currently is going on in your life, positive or negative. Notice we try and write these questions in such a way that they're maximally open. People can go whatever direction the context of their current experience is. That's what's cool about friendship ministry through stories. What's one of your most treasured family memories? You get to talk about your people, your past, and perhaps what you're wanting to see going on into the next generation. How do you stay connected with friends and family? What's interesting is community senior centers operating the internet. Looking at email programs, how do you text, how do you tweet, various afternoon classes at the senior citizen center. How do you stay connected? How are you in touch with your family? Conversation six, we're almost halfway through this. You're looking at work and career. Where have people been? What kind of work have they done? What kind of talents? What have they done for a living? What lessons have they learned? You're going to know some of this out of that asset-based organizational work that you do for your seniors ministry. But what lessons have you learned from your work? How do you continue to use your talents from your working years? And the idea is, if people have talents in retail, if they have talents in leadership, if they have talents in some kind of skill, how can they keep using that, though in a retirement level, where it's not the pressure to earn one's living, but the talents from which they draw, how do they keep enjoying that and feeling worthy and worthwhile from that? Conversation seven about community activities. What do you do to serve or give to others? Eric Erickson would say, you need to be of value, dear senior. And so what do you do that you do to give and serve other people? Again, one of these open-ended things. if you were to think and just do this silently, how would you complete the following sentence? I feel useful when... Well, guess what? You share that, you go public with another person or two that you're in conversation with, and you've almost got a commitment. I want to find ways to do that. Are you able to use career talents that currently, as a volunteer, could be very useful in this church or this community? There's a neat organization, Encore.com, and it's not a religious organization. I'll tell you about another one in a minute. But Encore, what do? Especially we boomers who've been to concerts and we're shouting at the end of the concert, we're clapping, we're on our feet, Encore, Encore, give us more. Well, how about God's kingdom? Give us more. The talents, come on, bravo, encore, encore. And so if you Google Encore Ministry, you're going to find some really neat stuff out of Evangelical Free Church and what they've done in mission work, in service, in caring, in frail seniors, the whole gamut. And they're one of the folks that I was looking at as kind of, here's the ideal ministry. But I guess what if I would give you one ideal out of what Susan and I are doing here in mobilizing is encourage your group to find their encore. What have they done well? What would they like to learn? What is it that they'd like to bring on the stage of their lives again for God and for community? Well, conversation 8 kind of goes right on in this. Lifelong learning. I love what Harry Emerson Fosdick said. Don't simply retire from something. Have something to retire to. And guess what? All these 12 conversations program, from marriage to the dating couples mentoring program that Susan and I wrote together, to the life after 60, the caregivers, the grief and loss, all of these are part of my retirement plan because I love getting out to churches on weekends and travel, but I have to be with Rhonda in such a hurry to get back for Monday morning teaching. We don't get to stay in places as long. And so one of the things that she and I plan to do in our retirement years is work with churches in marriage enrichment, marriage mentoring, and then these other senior topics. Have something to retire to. How do you see yourself continuing to grow and learn? What do you want? What one new thing do you want to learn? Get people talking and buzzing about that. Because maybe, yeah, I've had a curiosity about that too. What do you know about it? And they start pinging with each other on ideas. And that energy and synergy is created. What are you able to do now that you weren't able to do at earlier stages of in your life? You may have been too busy to do that, and now people have time. What is it that they now can do or have the money to do that they weren't able to do earlier? Grandparenting. Not everybody has grandkids, or it's not always peachy. So we talk about one of the questions being, how would you describe your style of grandparenting? And if you don't have grandkids, how do you give of yourself to the next generation? That is really important. What do you want to pass on? What kind of traditions do you want your grandchildren to understand and keep? And so since Susan is a grandmother and I'm not a grandparent, she's got a few things to share with us here for a moment on parenting the adult child and anything else you want to say about grandkids.
Briefly, there were two things that were requested of us. One was kind of working or parenting your adult child, I call it that. I remember when my children left home and I thought, well, I'm still their mom, but how do I parent an adult child? Remember, I'm a prayer list I keep. I remember writing that there and I thought, I need to think about that. So we're going to talk about that in grandparenting just briefly, just because we've been asked to do that. And I think that it is a natural progression, you hope, that your child will leave home at some point in time. But that's not necessarily expected for some. Some children leave home maybe to go to college or work opportunities or whatever. But then because of maybe economy or specific needs, they're back home again. And that may be okay and it may not. It's kind of the size of your home maybe and your relationship and a lot of things about that. But whatever it is, conflict is inevitable as our children grow older. And good, there's wonderful good things and there's kind of that too. But I think it's a little bit like the two-year-old again, as we've studied that two-year-old that wants the autonomy and their best word is no, me, mine, you know. And so kind of they're at that point again where they're wanting to establish their own autonomy, but then they're coming back saying, but I still need your house or your bedroom or your washing machine or your money or whatever. But children are not responsible for your happiness, and that's a hard one. I mean, they do bring it or not, but that's not really their responsibility to make you happy, although they do. Did you have a question, sir, or what?
Well, does that go the other way as well? I mean, okay.
Yeah. Oh, you definitely, and you're not responsible for theirs. It's definitely two ways. But sometimes the people, all of us, I think, our children, we have expectations for our children or grandchildren, and it doesn't always go the way we expected it to or thought it should or whatever. It won't. And so we may be disappointed or struggling with that. And so I think it's kind of working through that. And it is disappointing, but they're still my child. I still love them. It's maybe not what I wanted. You don't tell them that always, but inside you're feeling that. And they're probably thinking, too, I wish Dad was, you know, accepting me better, allowing me to do this, or made me feel better about this decision that I'm making. So I think it's kind of a two-way thing when we think about that. But they need to be independent from us, and yet, I have three grown children, very grown children, and yet I don't need to know everything about their life. They don't live with me anymore, so I don't have to know that. But I think there needs to be a certain, I don't need to know everything, tell me what you want me to know. I think with the cell phone era and younger generations than me, certainly having taught college for many, many years, there's an umbilical cord that needs to be cut there, I think, more. Our generation, it was easier because we didn't have that. We didn't have the cell phones.
We probably ought to move on. But the idea is, can you imagine seniors engaging one another over kind of what's going on with their adult kids and being able to commiserate maybe, but then also get some wisdom from one another about what they need to do?
Yeah, because they want to be trusted. They really do. They want to feel that. And I think this is when honor continues with obedience. And, you know, they don't need to obey you. And we hope that honor. We hope that. Listen to them. I mean, that's over and over. Ed's already said that. Always maintain a relationship, no matter how painful or difficult or disappointed it is. Maintain that relationship with them. Be their confident cheerleader. You know, rah, rah. I believe in you. I think you can do this. I'm right behind you. I'm your mom. I think there's nothing better with that. My grandchildren laugh because usually when I sign my name, I put proud grandma. You know? It's just, grandma, but maybe proud grandma. Be supportive but not directive. That's hard when they're older with that. Live your life as a blessing to them and not a burden. And the gentleman mentioned that, you know, what is that burden? And as you age, allow them to help you. And that's kind of what it is, I think, a little bit when we look at that. And then as far as grandchildren are concerned, for some of you I know in this room, I'm guessing, some of you really would like to be grandparents, and you're this generation, sometimes they don't marry, or they marry late, or they don't want kids. And so here you're sitting here wanting grandkids, and you aren't having them because there's many maybe reasons with that. So I know that's part of it. But if you are a grandparent, I think be supportive from a distance, even if they live nearby. You know, offer to babysit. That's when we become far more valuable, I think, at that time. Know your boundaries and the boundaries of the parents and preferences they have for their own children. and respect those boundaries. Sometimes you may not agree with them, but they might not want you to feed them or do this or take them or whatever it is. You kind of need to respect some of that. Give wonderful memories to your grandchildren. That's what I loved. I want to say we're going to, this is a memory we have. In fact, two of my college granddaughters are going to be living with me during First Walk Summer School now. And they said, it's going to be like grandma camp, grandma. Because when they're growing up, we had grandma camp. They would come stay at my house and we do things. So they're going to have grandma camp. Give wonderful, share the heritage with lots of storytelling, which we've been talking about. It's a blessing that. And share resources appropriately. That means your money, what you buy, what you give. Do that appropriately and with permission.
One of the interesting things is Susan is a wealth of wisdom about experiences in the family life cycle. And we could listen and enjoy listening to that, you know, week after week. I know we did at Sunny Hills when Terry and Susan would share about parenting. And there were some things, as we heard their story, we want to do that too. But notice what you're doing here is you're turning people loose with the car keys to drive and share their lives and their story. So we're not telling one another how to do things. We're encouraging them to share their experience with one another and then do that kind of bonding. Well, Conversation 10, 11, and 12, and we'll be done with Life After 60 as far as a tool. But spirituality and purpose, these are important because Eric Erickson, from just a psychologist perspective, would say that sense of meaning about your life, and we know that comes out of our spirituality. So what gives us our sense of purpose in life? These are written in such a way that you could do this in a community grant-funded center or an outreach of your church to unchurched people to still bring the God topic up. And for us as Christians, that's real easy. God's a part of our story. What are you doing to meet someone else's needs? What's been one of your most rewarding life experiences? When you look at how you get through experiences of loneliness, what makes a difference to you? And, of course, God helps us in that. There are all kind of opportunities to share who we are as God's children. And yet we ask the questions in an open way that leave that story to be told, not prescribing what someone should say. And then going back to that list of problem-solving skills, we know the prayer that the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr prayed and wrote that AA is taken and just run with. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So whether it's grandchildren, our adult children, whether it's stage of life and whatever may be going on in a senior's life, we believe that seniors have experience and wisdom. They've got success in their past, and they can apply that if we just give them the supportive relationship, that red pie chart relationship part of the graph. And so they don't have to always be at the elder's desk or table getting counsel. They can do this with one another. So we want people to look at what are some of the recent changes in their life, what's going on, what stresses have they encountered, and how are they coping with them? How can you accept help from others? Some people, myself, ministers, doctors, nurses, counselors, we're some of the worst help receivers. You ministers, you're used to giving to people, being there for them. And when do you let someone be there for you? Give an example. Tell a story. Okay. When we go to integrity, conversation 12, I love this quote. The measure of a man's real character is what he would do if he knew he would never be found out. And we know from Erickson, from a psychology perspective, there is this sense of ego integrity. And so what's been one of the most important persons in our life? How did he or she influence you? What have you learned from your past that helps you be a better person today? And so can you imagine Tuesday mornings or Thursday afternoons or whenever your seniors group wanted to do coffee and small tables, one to one or two to one, you know, kind of people sharing or in one another's homes. Find ways to use this resource, to engage people to be the one another passages that we see all throughout the epistles. Bear one another's burdens, all the one another passages that we see. These three conversation guides are one anothering tools, if you will. One of the things that Susan, she's a great, we'll call her a pusher. She's not a drug pusher, but she's an idea pusher. And she says, Ed, we need to do a caregiver's 12 conversations booklet. So when Susan calls, I say, well, let me give that some thought. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Susan, have you ever been accused of being a pusher?
Well, I don't know. Pushover, maybe.
Not a pushover. Well, I found a quote that Rosalind Carter made. She said, there are only four kinds of people in the world. Those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregiving. If you want to read an interesting book, Helping Yourself Help Others, a book for caregivers. So we wrote this 12 Conversations book of guidelines, if you will, just to give people some structure for caregivers to share with one another in this 24/7 kind of journey, to provide support for one another as they juggle all the different demands that are required of caregivers. And it is really game on with very little break oftentimes. And so since Susan has had a number of caregiving journeys throughout her life, she's going to get to run most of this. So let's let her reflect theologically a little bit on a real caregiving relationship between Naomi and Ruth.
You know, Mike, you're familiar with this story. I'm sure I don't need to go into all of it. But when you think of Ruth and Orpah and Orpah. You know, they were daughters-in-laws. They were daughters, and Naomi was said she was a bitter woman. Now Naomi's not the only person that was a widow. Ruth was a widow too, and we forget that. We think, you know, Ruth, she's younger, and so she needs to take care of Naomi, which is wonderful. But she's a grieving widow too. And she has no children. And so there's ever so much I could go into this story. But when you look at the story, it's about a caregiving situation. It's about a grieving situation and a loss situation. And sometimes we use this scripture in marriage ceremonies, and I guess it's okay. But
it's really about a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law.
And, you know, I had a real-life story with that. When my husband was dying, my daughter-in-law came and stayed with me and walked that journey with me to relieve me of some things. And I have a wonderful daughter-in-law, and so she was Ruth and Naomi, I'll tell you. And her name is Paula. She married my son, Paul. And he had just finished his medical school and was in a residency, and she had some time to come. Anyway, it's a long story. But I do understand this story of Ruth and Naomi and the relationship that was there and the caregiving that was going on. I would like to think it was mutual. I don't know. It doesn't tell us if Naomi was. She was. She gave Ruth some good advice, I think. And Ruth was going to a foreign land. She was going to Naomi's land. Not her. She was a, quote, foreigner there. And so she had to adjust to this whole probably new culture. She was a Christian. New, maybe. We don't know how new, but I mean, it was a whole new believer situation. So think about that relationship, I think, when we think of caregiving or when we think of grief and loss. But we're kind of focusing on caregiving here. Do you have whatever you want to do? Okay, this book, we'll just go quickly through this. This book was written, as you can see, by Gail Sheehy. Done a lot of research. She's not a Christian woman per se. I don't want to stand in judgment, but it's not that kind of book, I guess I should say.
And the story of her journey with her husband.
Yeah,
Mm-hmm. And when he was dying, and it's really when they first used the term palliative care. Now, we know what hospice care is, but palliative care is really prior to that time when they kind of come alongside someone who is dying or very, very ill, and there's many resources that help the person on that journey. In the book, she gives a job description of what a caregiver is: untrained family member or friend to act as an advocate, researcher, care manager, and emotional support for a parent or spouse, sibling, or friend who has been diagnosed with a serious illness or chronic disability. That's been my life since I was in second grade, when my sister got polio and couldn't walk, and from then on, she was my older sister, but I really became the older sister in many ways and the caregiver. So most of my life I've been in some form of this journey. The duties here: make medical decisions, negotiate with insurance companies, Medicare, pay bills, legal work, personal care and entertainment in hospital or rehab, substitute for skilled nurse, injections, wound care, bedpans, or special feeding required. That was a high. I was never called to be a nurse. Didn't want to be. I was called to be a teacher, I thought. But when my husband was dying, I did all that because I loved him. It was not easy, but you do it because you do love them. Long-term care, medication management, bathing, toileting, lifting, transporting, etc. Hours on demand, salary, zero. So that's the gist when we think of that, what that's all about. This is what she calls the kaleidoscope of problems that caregivers deal with: depression and sadness, very much so. Anger, guilt, kind of because they're angry, part of that. Worry about many things, including the one cared for. Many worries, and you can't express them really to that other person because you don't want to burden them with it, and yet you're carrying that load a little bit. Isolation, loss of relationships sometimes because you can't give time to those relationships. Resentment, maybe loss of employment. Many times with that, it was very interesting at Pepperdine here. We have a wonderful human resources department, and they found that there's many people on campus who are caregivers. Now, in many ways, they're young and old. They're caregiving for handicapped children or elderly parents or whatever. So they asked me if I would do a seminar for some of the employees here. And I said, fine. So I guess they put it out online. And within an hour, the class was full and a huge waiting list, which said how much we need this topic. And I'm talking again about the caregiver, not the one cared for. I want you to remember what this is about.
Think about how many people in your church are providing caregiving for a family member. When those of us who are boomers are launching our children, we may also then turn right around and already be or be soon caregiving. Yes. And so it's really like a break doesn't occur. I was on the plane flying out here with Rhonda to the lectures, and the lady sitting next to me saw the PowerPoint stuff that I was working on, and she started pouring out her heart about her caregiving journey. She happens to work for Johnson & Johnson. She said, our human relations HR department would love to have this resource.
Well, what was interesting, and then, of course, then I did another session because there were so many on the waiting list. But then I encouraged the lady that I was working with in human resources. I said, what you need to do is put together a list and a handout of all the things Pepperdine does for the caregiver and what's available for them. And she said, yeah. And she came up with amazing things. And the people then in the class were like, whoa, this is great. And I won't go into how it's done, but the point is it was extremely, I guess, helpful to them because nobody talks. I can't remember when I was a caregiver, anybody saying, Susan, how are you doing? It was always, how's your sister doing, or how's your mom doing?
And yet we've got to be caring for the caregiver, because if the caregiver goes down, guess what? The person who is ill is really up a creek.
Yeah. So just think about who is a caregiver. And, of course, we care for the one who's being cared for. But the point is, and when I called Anna this, I said, there's just nothing written for caregivers, and we need to do that. So anyway, some things to
You got the, okay. The challenge, approximately 9 million Americans require long-term care. They need help with such basics as getting out of bed, eating, dressing, cooking, and paying bills. Even as I finally, it's a long story, got my sister into some care, I had to pay extra to get a lot of that done. That's when, anyway, a lot of things were going on. Right? But just getting, I did the laundry and paying the bills, but just helping getting her out of bed, helping getting her dressed, helping her get to bed at night, all those things if you need help with. Less than 2 million live in nursing homes. Most live at home, cared for by family and friends.
So again, if you think of engaging your boomers, and what you want them to get engaged in older adult ministry, well, guess what? Here's something that really camps out on many of them in your churches is the caregiving journey.
Mm-hmm. And then approximately 50 million Americans provide the majority of the help needed by relatives or friends who are elderly, ill, or disabled. So it means they're not hiring this being done. Those figures are only going to grow. Think about what we've already been telling you about our aging population. The number of people 65 and older is expected, again, to double in the next 40 years, and the number of those over 85 will be more than tripling. So just, in other words, think about the reality of this particular subject as we think about that. You know, we all, as Christians, I think, know that we have an expected responsibility that's talked about throughout Scripture. And sometimes that's easier said than done. You know, how do we work that? We honor my father and mother. I did. I wanted to. But how do you do that when you're ill and when you struggle with all those issues? So there's a lot of challenges. It is easier said than done. My personal story, you can probably read about it at the beginning of the book more than I won't go into a lot of detail. But I think part of it, as Ed was saying, which parent goes first depends sometimes on how the caregiving is going to be. You know, my father went before my mother. She cared for him. I cared for my husband. But when I went through cancer, he wasn't there to care for me. I was alone. I mean, my kids were wonderful, but it's kind of who goes first and who's there by themselves when they need care and the spouse isn't there for the care. Whatever, it's a different kind of journey, I think, for them to think about, you know, who's going first with this journey. But I cared, you know, for my sister, as I said, and all of her. And she never had children. I was her only sibling. She only wanted me, really. So it was an interesting process in caring for her for many years. I drove down to Long Beach, if any of you are familiar with that, living here, to care for her by house. I live on campus, it's three stories, so there's no way she could function in that. But it was hard to get her to understand my world. I had a job, I had grandkids and kids, and men, you know. But she would always say, I would say, Carol, why don't you consider moving out near me? I want to talk about it. For 10 years, she kept saying that. I want to talk about it, you know. And so it's just delicate conversations that you have to prepare them for that next level of care and what they need. And I did something pretty creative to work with that, but maybe we don't have time for all of that. And then with my mother, my father had died, and mother had a stroke. And this is when my husband was just finishing cancer treatments. My son and both daughters were pregnant. My son was in medical school. My sister's husband had just died. I mean, I had a lot on my plate. I had a lot on my plate. And I said, Lord, I know you don't give us more than we can bear, but I think you think more highly of me right now. I'm not sure I'm really up to all that. But I think then with my mother, because of where I lived and my sister couldn't care for her and I was caring for my dying husband, I had to put her in assisted living, which was lovely next to the church and all that. But in my head was tremendous guilt. Because my father always said, don't ever put me in a home, you know, in that hole. And I remember the day I had it, I said, Dad, I'm sorry, you know. I did what I had to do, and she was well cared for. But those messages in our brain, and that was my dad's, and he kind of made sure we didn't ever put him in a home. I don't know. But those are the guilts, the things that we work through, I think, in our caregiving.
I tried to keep a balance in my life, though, I think, through all of that, and trying to care for myself, as Ed said, tried to assess situations as they came, as I could see kind of dementia setting in with my mother and my sister, and how to assess that, how to care for that, how to talk to them about that. It's a whole long book that you'll see here. Okay, it's a sad journey. I remember leaving my sister toward the end. I just was sad. It was just a sad thing. And kind of working, I think, through that. And of course, caring for my dying husband was the most emotionally, spiritually draining part. And it is a spiritual journey. You know, those of us as Christians have to realize it's not just a physical journey. It's not just a journey. It's a spiritual journey that you need to walk with us on in this journey and keep us kind of connected with that and not chiding us or guilt-ridding us about that, but praying with us, I think, is very important. But since we're living longer, it's older people taking care of their parents, see? And so it's not young people. It's older people with that. And I think that you can't force any decisions, but be very creative about the way you guide them to a decision, as I did with my sister and trying to get her to move. In your book, just to kind of highlight things for you here, when I write, I mean, the teacher in me, just, as Ed knows, just couldn't stand not to put something besides questions in it. So in this book and the other book, we have what we call considers.
The teacher, and then you have the questions, the counselor. What a great combination. It's like peanut butter and chocolate.
But I just thought there are just a few principles, I guess basic principles, that I thought if you're going to be working with, so in every chapter or conversation, it has considers, and then it'll have questions. So that means you kind of look, those are just some principles to think, consider, some principles to maybe kind of give you a foundation for your discussion or your what you're talking about. And so you might look through that. There's the table of contents. You can see all the topics that we cover here.
About the only guideline change is we tell people, do not give medical advice.
Right. Yeah. And don't, well, when we get to grief and loss, I'll do that. But you can't do that. you have to realize that my son's a medical doctor, and he's had some pretty difficult situations with people that they wait too late to come to the doctor, and then they want the doctor to solve all their problems and they don't follow the instructions, and then they blame the doctor for it. So you have to kind of realize the role you play and the role you don't play, I think, with anything like that. But as you can see in the table of contents, we talked about life before the diagnosis, the beginning of the journey, physical care, challenges of the care, your medical team, and choosing all of that, wow, and relating to that, relationship roles, support networks, managing outcomes, legal and financial matters, whoa, that's a big one, self-care for the caregiver, community, planning for the future, if you're saying goodbye. And so those are some interesting, I think, hopefully helpful conversations for you. You can look at, you know, different questions they have that are here. You know, how has this diagnosis affected your life? I'm not going to go through it because of time. I know you can read, but I encourage you. This could be a one-on-one, as Ed said, or a small group, or maybe someone at your church that is a caregiver, and you might say, you know what, you might have read a couple chapters, and I'll come over and we'll talk about them, something like that.
Yeah. My church, one Wednesday night, had a social worker come and talk about this stage of life. They had a director, an administrator from a care facility, nursing home, and they had a counselor, moi. And so as I did cleanup, bat number three, I said, how many of you would like to sit around for the next 12 weeks on Wednesday night and have some conversation? Instantly, we had about half the class wanted to do this. We had an instant support group. Some people who really needed to talk, really needed somebody to understand and to help them. And just, it's kind of like having that kindred spirit who knows what you're going through and they get it. So however you might use this, I had one church in Oklahoma They were LifeChurchTV.tv. Anyway, that was their... And they wanted to use this because they're such an internet church. They said, we've got some caregivers who cannot ever leave the house unless somebody comes to be at the house. Could we put this online? And they had then Skype conversation groups like GoToMeeting.com kind of thing, and they could have people virtually be in group together talking, sharing their stories, because, you know, sometimes somebody's figured out something that you yet haven't figured out. And so it's helpful to hear somebody's experience, their story. And so tremendous opportunities as you get caregivers connected with one another. Grief and loss. We think of the next conversation guide being that idea that in 1 Corinthians, actually 2 Corinthians chapter 1, praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our trouble so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. And I think that is where we see kind of our mission in bearing one another's burdens and helping through grief and loss. Rhetorical question, because we don't have time to do this, but what's the first loss you remember experiencing? My grandfather was the first death I experienced. And think about sharing that now as an adult as you're going through a current grief experience. Grief work is important, and we know that the narratives of our life with the person or the loss that has been encountered is so important to tell the story, to retell the story. And when those of you who preach funerals tell the story about this person's life, how almost healing and connecting that is once again. I had a dear friend whose wife died of cancer in her early 50s. And he said passionately, please do not forget Debbie. Tell me stories about Debbie. Because what do people do? We want to get them through it. We want to get them over it. Don't talk about it. We don't know what to say. We say stupid things like God needed another angel in heaven. Bad theology. And, you know, it dishonors the person who's grieving. But Alan said, you have had interactions with Debbie that I don't know about. Please tell me Debbie stories.
Yes.
So, types of grief and loss, Susan. And I'll hand out any more books. Anybody else need a conversation book?
There's so much. Of course, I could spend 3 hours talking about this topic, too. But when we talk about grief and loss, there's a lot of kinds. You might have lost a child, you lose your health, your identity, your job, your possessions, your loved ones, your reputation. Lots of types of loss. So grief and loss can be, we grieve all of those things, and we lose all those things. So I just want you to know, you could look at that big picture if you want to when you look at that. I think any grieving and loss is unique to the person.
Yes.
It's a lonely time. It doesn't follow necessarily a prescribed order. There is some studies on it, and they're good, and I think they're viable, and I've got bookshelves on all of this. But I don't think you can kind of make it your own in that way. So what have you got? He's pushing the button, so I'm going to kind of stand where I can see. But I think that it doesn't follow that timeline. As he said, sharing of the loss is okay. People would say, well, I don't want to say anything because she might cry. Well, I'm probably going to cry anyway.
Part of the healing process.
I mean, so I cry. Yeah, I cry a lot. But I also, you know, went on, and I wanted people to say, I admire your courage, Susan. I wanted to hear that. You know, instead of ignoring me or being uncomfortable with me, which I knew they were, they just kind of didn't want to talk to me because they didn't know what to say. Well, okay, we'll tell you what to say.
but also would hurt my feelings because I knew they were ignoring me, not because I did personally, but because I knew that it made me feel very isolated. Because people were like, poor Susan, you know, I don't want to say, so I'm just going to pretend like I don't. It's not there. Well, it's there, and ignoring it didn't take it away. So think about that. With that, and as a widow, and I'm not going to go into a lot of that, but remember that no matter how long she's a widow, I think going to church is the loneliest time. For me, my husband sat beside me all the time, and he sang bass, and I miss that. We hold hands during prayer sometime, and do you think that just goes away, that longing, that missing, that go away? And so sometimes I'm going to church and look around and think, where will I sit this time? Where will I sit by? I'd love someone to say, hey, Susan, want to come sit by me? Students do that to me, so guys love it. But just realize that's a lonely place for them sometimes with your widows. And we try to kind of have a, shall we say, widows group, and divorced women too. But they were basically saying, I don't want a special group with that title. I don't want that to be my identity. They didn't just want, they wanted to be with other people, men, women, couples. They didn't want to just have their little exclusive group of widows. Now, if you're in a mega church, that might be good because there's lots of them. But I was a young widow. That wasn't an identity. Do you understand? So don't just think, oh, well, they can form a widow's group and they're going to be all taken care of. Out of my hair. But not necessarily. They're still people, normal people with longings as you think about them. So even in death, if death itself, if you've got that here, that's okay. Even if death itself is not feared, I think what it is, the dying process is what we fear. I don't fear death, but when you think, am I going to be in pain and dementia or Alzheimer's for years? Or I think that's what fears us most, or scares us most, and it's not just death itself, I think, at that time.
There was a minister preaching a funeral, and he said something very memorable. We as Christians live for this day, and yet we fear this day.
Well, and I think part of it is, for me, you know, my husband went through cancer and oncology, and I knew all those words in that term, and I wanted to know when my turn came, and I had to go there. My son was with me, and I said, Paul, you need to hold my hand when I walk in that door, because I just know too much about this there. And I said, hope they've redecorated. They have. But anyway, but the point was, whoa, I know too much about this. And so that's just all part of that process, I think. But the best way to prepare ourselves for living well is to prepare ourselves for dying well. And when I say that, there's, and the book will be full of a lot of things here for you, but to think about, I need to, in some ways, make plans. I mean, my kids know where my trust is, they know where my paperwork is, they know what my wishes are. I've already got a burial plot with my husband. I mean, but they need to know that, first of all, but some people won't talk about that. I know somebody who wishes her parents would, and they won't. And that's not doing anybody a service with that. But once you've discussed it, it's done. You don't have to talk about it anymore. I mean, who wants to talk about that? But you do at some point, and then it's good. But I was with my grandfather, my mother, my sister, and all my husband. And my husband. But I was at the moment of death. And that's an amazing spiritual journey. It's a memory you don't forget, but it is a journey. So grief and loss is something I am familiar with, and in putting the considers that are on this book and all, they were written from my heart, from experience, but and a lot of research too as we think about that with all those people. But I found people were very uncomfortable with me, and I don't think it was because of me. And I was in a younger community, of course, and I was in an academic community, and sometimes I hate to say it, but they're not very good about things like that. But some quick thoughts that I want to have you about ministering to those in grief and loss. One, don't second-guess their decisions.
That's right.
If they've decided that they're going to have
surgery and chemotherapy and radiation or whatever it is, don't say, oh, but I know a place in Mexico you should go in, or there's this place you should do. I mean, I have stacks of that. If they've made a decision, just honor that and love them through it, and don't second guess it or try to tell them something better. It's just not going to be helpful to them. It wasn't to me, and I, even a book that they sent, like, if you just prayed right, he'd be healed. How do you think that made me feel? Like, whoa, he's dying because I'm not praying right? Whoa. I mean, there's some really interesting.
Or you didn't feed them right, or get into this alternative therapy.
It was my fault he was dying because I didn't feed him right. I heard that one too. Do you think that made me feel better and minister too? No. That wasn't true.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think certainly in this helped to simplify the physical needs that are happening at that time for cleaning or food or shopping or fixing, as you mentioned, or transportation. When my husband was in, so, you know, just going to treatment all the time, and I kind of had a life that people would volunteer to drive him, and they loved doing it because he was fun, you know. And so they were all, I want to take Terry. I don't want to sign up to go. That was really helpful to me to take him to some of his treatments. And it's not about you. People say, I don't know what to say. I want to say, but it's not about you. It's not what you want to say. It's what it's about that person. If you're ministering to them, it's not about you worrying about what you're going to say, because it's not about you. And so we have to get over that fact of, you know, how we're feeling about that. It's okay to ask questions. And I think that's important, you know, like... even if the one, how are you doing? How are you handling this? That's okay. How did this happen? When you died, when did you first find out about it? There's some really some rather beautiful stories about Terry's death. Some beautiful things he wrote that I know some of you in this room have read. So it's not, it's sad, but it's beautiful, isn't it, Joel?
Yes.
And so don't be afraid to ask about that and have them tell the story, because that is something you will learn from too. And that person usually won't mind talking about that. Listen and lament. Scripture's full of laments.
Yes.
Crying's okay. Being sad is okay. Lamenting a loss. Don't try to protect them from it. You're not protecting them from it anyway. Don't try to act like it's not there, because it is, but then you just make them hold it inside more, which is not helpful. There's that elephant in the room. People sometimes, when Terry was dying, and that was a long 6-month period, and it's a sad process to watch a body just dwindle, but people would come and they'd talk about everything but that. I'm like, what are you here for anyway? I mean, it was just kind of because they just didn't know what to say, I guess, they thought. So listen well to, but not to critique, but to suffer with them when you lament. Do not force a relationship that's not there before, or ignore a relationship that is there. I really found this. Some people, boy, they wanted to know all the details, and I hardly even knew them, so they could go out and tell everybody, all the. And that, when I found out about that, I thought, who are you to... And if they confide in you, that's a confiding. And then when they go out and tell everybody, that's not helpful. So, boy, into that one. But if you have a close relationship with them, don't ignore that. They notice that when someone is grieving. Grievers may have spiritual doubts. They will. And anger. And worship may be difficult. Don't chide them for that. Walk that journey with them. Let them understand that it's okay to talk to you about that, or I can see how you would feel that way. I can see how going to church is difficult instead of saying, oh, what? Let them, you know, validate that, I think, for them. Pray with them. I remember one lady that came over, and this sounds so simple. It sounds so simple, but she came over. This was not long after Terry died, and we sat on my terrace, and it was sunset time, and I told her, I said, I don't go to his grave a lot, I have, because I don't feel as close to him there, but when I sit here and I see the sunset,
I blow kisses to him. I've told my students this. I said, I stand there even to this day, and I'll blow kisses to those beautiful sunsets that he loved. And I would think, you know, he has seen something so beautiful now, far more beautiful than this beautiful Malibu sunset. And I feel close to him then. And my students are kind of, I think it's kind of good for them to hear that a little bit, to know that even now that I do that. But this lady then did that. And then she said, Susan, can I just pray with you? And I'm like, yes. And do that with them. It's simple, quote unquote. So don't be, they're fragile people, but they spiritual doubts are kind of okay, and it's an incredible journey. And don't forget them in years to come. You know, guess what? We still miss Terry. There's still that big void in our life. And of course, we love stories about him. People don't, you know, they always say, I don't know what to say. Well, get your book out here, okay? There's so much here that we are going to give you samples to do as far. One of the things I think will really help you with this, if you know someone at church who is grieving, I went to a support group through our medical community. It was just so not helpful. And it so didn't touch me spiritually or any other way. And I told my son that. I said, Paul, it's just not. He said, well, Mom, just don't go. I thought, well, I should. I deserve being helped. I want this, but it wasn't helping. But I think something as simple as a book like this, just say, you sit in a small group or a large group and pick out a question and they can answer it or not, because it's talking about experiencing grief and loss, understanding the kinds, sharing your journey, experiencing the pain, understanding the stages, guiding family and others with your loss, facilitating grief journeys, advice for caregivers and that, remembering life before the loss. Don't forget, you know, he had those, the Grinch and the Scrooge, but the opposite, he had a life before that. Adjusting your life and expectations mentally, you know, emotionally, socially, spiritually, a lot of life adjustments that go on with that. Adjusting physically and financially. Terry prepared me well, and then before he died, I said, Terry, and he loved taking care of me, he said, but I said, you will take care of me the rest of my life. Because financially, he was very wise and very smart, and he still takes care of me financially because of that. Viewing new horizons for your life, getting wisdom, giving wisdom when you're ready, you know, scriptures when you're ready, because then there's a list there. So, and there's some wonderful questions there that I think will help you as you minister to people like this in the, let's see, I think there's one more. Did you, where's your clicker? I'm sorry, I can do it if I had it. The purpose of life is not to be happy. It's to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well. I think that's what seniors really want to. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, as you know, she studied grief and journey a lot, this whole journey. She says, the most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths. These persons have an appreciation, sensitivity, and an understanding of life that fills them with compassion, gentleness, and a deep loving concern. Beautiful people do not just happen. And I think they're our senior citizens. So, anyway, here also with that, we have, excuse me, here we go. Well, they don't like me very well, does it, Ed?
It's gotten so used to me that...
It's okay. Anyway, in your packet, there's some marvelous, we think, suggestions for your senior ministry for you to read and get ideas from and to share at your church. And then also, there's another one that, anyway, it's okay. It's not that important, but some resources and a lot of them that we have quoted from here in the class that you have. I know we're kind of rushing it. There's so much I'd like to say about these last topics, but he's preparing the certificates for you now. We would love for you, we can stay as long as you want to ask questions. Are there some general questions that you have? I just want you all to go and serve your seniors. Yes, sir.
I'm
I have one comment. I've discovered that the worst thing you can say is say nothing.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's so painful.
It is so painful. I even had a relative live very close to me, and almost for a year, she never came by the house, and I always initiated everything, and finally, she was in such grief, she had to go into counseling. Oh. I thought, well, yeah, but what am I? You know, I say people only think about their needs. It's very hard for them to think, what does that person need right now? Yes, sir. Yeah, and then you.
Sometimes we worry so much about the correct words.
And there aren't.
But I tell you, you just go up and give them a hug.
Yeah. Oh, yes, as he said.
Show them, you know, the touching.
Yeah, and you'll notice one of the chapters here, I should have gotten the but it will give you a whole list here on page 26 to 27. What to say, what not to say. Oh, I could spend a lot of time on that one. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
That things that are not helpful. In fact, I was talking to someone this week who's experiencing something.
It says something and you go, that's not really what I needed to hear, and your heart kind of sinks. I mean, you can at least acknowledge that and help the conversation, because sometimes the awkwardness, the admission of the awkwardness and the starting point is not necessarily where you want to end up.
It certainly can be. And you know, some of it I just kind of just ignored or just said thank you or whatever. And some of it, of course, many things that were helpful. But some of it, it just wasn't. And so anyway, there's some of that in here also in the book. And you might, again, and it's not that there's a right thing to say, but usually the simplest is the best. Just something like, just giving them a hug at church, just a greet, or been thinking about you. You can ask how they're doing, but don't say how you doing and then leave. I mean, you may not want, I think it's just a matter of how much. And it doesn't have to be a big deal, but it means you're acknowledging the feelings that you know they're feeling. Like, as I said, sometimes if just people said to me, you know, I admire your courage, or when I was going through cancer and all the chemo and all the stuff with that, and as people say, how are you doing? I say, well, I'm persevering, because I was, but I wasn't fine necessarily, but, you know, I said, that was my word.
No, I was just, I really was going to say the same thing that you said, and you said something that was important, you know, thinking about what the other person means. We're not all wired the same.
Yes.
And so when you consider how that person is wired, because I'm the person where I really don't want you to say anything.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I've found that, you know, when I've touched somebody, I lost my mom.
Uh-huh.
And those who have lost their mothers, when I have just touched them.
Yeah.
And just nodded or held their hand, you know, that's full volume without, you know,
saying something that didn't really fit or hurt or was stupid.
And I was saying with this conversation this week, it was a man whose wife is going through a cancer similar to mine. And we were talking, and but as we talked, I said, my guess is this is what's happening. And my guess is, this is what people are saying to you that's not helpful. And he got tears in his eyes. He said, yeah, you know. It's because I know that journey from both sides of that fence. And it was like, whoa, someone gets it. Right? You know, does that make sense? And it's not a bigger, but it's like, as you say with your mom or something, they get it. They can go there with me because they've kind of been there.
A couple of closing things. Faith works. Faith engages. And hopefully we've given you some tools today to engage seniors in ministry that really can make a difference. Let's pray as we close. Father God, thank you for what each heart in this room brings to your kingdom. Father, help open our eyes to show up and be your people. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. That was very good.